Members, we are going to call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We're going to get going right on the dot of 3 because we have a rather aggressive agenda and we're hoping to be done by 3:45. With that, Representative Rarick, welcome to the committee. Talk a little bit slowly because we do not have a quorum. We can't vote on your bill yet, but I will move House File 1204.
What's that?
Technically, we're not supposed to move the bill when we don't have a quorum, so House File 1204 will be discussed, but don't be under any illusions. We are not moving this bill right now. Representative Rarick, to your bill that's not being moved right now, but will be as soon as we have 6 more people here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and since I have a little bit of time, I want to recognize all the construction trade people that are here at the Capitol today, being I'm doing a Department of Labor bill. We have the electrical workers, laborers, 49ers, carpenters, and sheet metal workers here today, so it's great to have them all here and at the Capitol talking to us. So, what we have with House File 1204 is the Department of Labor's housekeeping bill. A lot of it was before us last year. I don't know if you want me to go through article by article.
Why don't you just hit the highlights on each article just so people know?
Okay. Section 1 is just a proposed amendment that removes erroneous references to licensing. Section 2 clarifies Section 184.4.1 by removing unnecessary language. Section 3 clarifies the process used when the department receives construction codes and licensing division application that contains deficiencies. Section 4 clarifies that high pressure piping code is now part of the state building code. Section 5 replaces references to continuing education units with actual hours. Section 6 proposed amendment eliminates transitional language allowing master elevator constructors to be exempt until January 20. I believe we have a typo here on the dates, but it is okay. So exempt from until January 1, 2014 for certain laws that were enacted in 13. Section 7 eliminates transitional language allowing journeyman elevator constructors to be exempt. Same thing. Section 8 removes transitional language for unlicensed electrical or elevator workers. Section 9, again, same thing for a different group, the elevator electrical contractors. Section 10 adds the word not, which was erroneously left out of the section in 16. Section 11 moves a sentence regarding the plumbing bond to clarify that the requirement applies to all plumbing bonds, not just for plumbing and sewage or subsurface sewage treatment. Section 12 through 23 would replace outdated terms with more modern terms for consistency between high pressure piping licenses and other licenses issued by the Department of Labor. Section 24 instructs the revisor's office to renumber, and section 25 is a repealer for obsolete rules.
Representative Rarick, thank you. I see Mr. Rakowski here. Mr. Rakowski, do you want to come up and talk to us? And Representative Rarick, I think I speak for the whole committee saying we were a little bit worried about the authorship of this bill. We're happy you took over. Mr. Rakowski.
Members, he just got this bill. I'm John Rakowski, Government Affairs Director with the Department of Labor and Industry, and Representative Rarick just got this bill yesterday. So, but he did forget Article 2, my favorite topic, combative sports. Article 2 and 3 were added this year. For those of you who may recall, Commissioner Peterson is the Commissioner of Combative Sports for the state of Minnesota, which includes boxing and mixed martial arts. Once a year, the Association of Boxing Commissions has a convention, And they passed
a
resolution, I guess, to adopt the boxing rules to MMA. And we thought we could do it by reference, but the revisor said no, we had to go through the legislative process. So that was section one. Section two is from last year that make some changes to make to help promoters in mixed martial arts pay us ahead of time as much as possible and have their event go up as well as it can. Then section three, that's also from last year. We're actually making them pay like our brothers in labor here. They pay for their license ahead of time. These guys hadn't, so we're asking them to please pay for their license ahead of time. And the rest, I believe, are repealers. That's all I have to say.
Thank you,
that.
Mr. Rakowski. Members, any questions? Seeing none, is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody run down. Representative Rarick, while you were describing the bill, while you were running through it, we did have enough members come in for a quorum, so we are officially legal. So I will move House File 1204 so that it is officially before the committee. Representative Rarick, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your support so we can get back to jobs. And
sounds good to us. And Representative Rarick, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1204 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Rakowski. Thank you, Representative Rarick. And members and testifiers, I think that is an excellent example of the expediency with which we'd like every bill to go today. And we will be done by 3:45. Thank you, gentlemen. Up next, Representative Fenton. And members, we my apologies. I neglected to put a copy of the minutes in the packet. They're being distributed now. So, Representative Rosenthal, whenever you get a chance to look at the minutes, no hurry. We don't have to do it immediately. But okay. And we also have a couple of 1377 handouts that are in the 1477 packet. So check around. We wanted to be a little bit of a scavenger hunt today. So go with that. Representative Fenton, to your bill, if you want to go ahead and move your bill, we'll proceed.
I'd like to move House File 1477.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Go ahead.
So thank you. So right now the current law dictates that credit unions must mail out the paper notices of membership meetings to every single member. Regardless of their stated preferences for receiving communications. So this bill not only creates parity with the federal level, but it would give credit unions flexibility to how they notify their members and allow them to use their electronic communication. And this is going to save our credit union guys a lot of time and money, so they're actually not in town right now. They may be on a warm island somewhere. I don't know.
We had Mr. DeLaForest listed your just for questions. Okay, that sounds like a good idea. Members, any questions on this bill? Representative Fenton, is there anybody opposed to this? I know it's a credit union bill, but are the banks or anybody else? No one has contacted me, not seen anybody around the table. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Fenton, with that, we'll give you the final word.
Members, it's a great day where we can all agree. So with that, this is a good bill, and I renew my motion for House File 1477 to
move to the Committee on Jobs.
Thank you.
Sorry, to the General Register. Sorry, I read my own notes wrong. And with that, members, Representative Fenton renews her motion. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Fenton. Thank you, members.
Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
I'd like to move the minutes of February 22nd.
Representative Rosenthal, as you know, this is a moving target, but you are my favorite committee member. Thank you. Members, any questions on the minutes from yesterday or last Wednesday's meeting? Comments? Roll call being denied. Representative Rosenthal moves the adoption of the minutes from our last meeting. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Representative Albright, I see you here. Well, we don't have to do that one today. Okay. Why don't we do that? Representative Vogel. Oh, Representative Albright.
Vogel.
That was close. Representative Albright, I will move House File 1415 so that it is in front of the committee. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Hain, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Albright, thank you. And whenever you're ready, please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, members, and Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak before you on House File 1415. Members, this is a bill that was discussed with a robust conversation last session, last biennium, when we bring it before you again. This is the fantasy sports bill. I will lead off because I understand that there may be some in the audience that may disagree with the intent here, but I also have a testifier to the point that may be raised about the fantasy sports. But fantasy sports is much like you would discuss a PGA event, where there is a goal and there is a skill, and you enter into the arena with the opportunity to be competitive based upon your skill in preparing yourself, as well as collecting the right arsenal of tools, much like you would in a fantasy sports, where it takes a great deal of understanding in terms of the players that you want to assemble on your team, the preparation and how you utilize those on a daily or weekly basis for a season's intent, with the goal of achieving the prize, in this case, a part of the purse. So that being said, Mr. Chair and members, I would introduce you my testifier and have him explain some of the oversight issues in the bill and await your questions.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Whoever wants to go first, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, my name is Derek Hine, and I am the Manager of Government Affairs for DraftKings. I am here representing the whole fantasy sports industry, not just DraftKings, but also FanDuel, the Fantasy Sports Trade Association, and any other paid fantasy sports operators who currently or wish to operate in the state of Minnesota. In an effort to expedite things, just real briefly, DraftKings has been around since 2012. We're based in Boston, Massachusetts, and we employ approximately 300 people. We've been operating here in the state of Minnesota since 2012. A number of other fantasy sports operators have been operating here since prior to that time. This bill does nothing to expand gaming in any way. This is something that's already occurring in the state of Minnesota. We estimate that 900,000 residents of Minnesota play these games in some variety, 167,000 of those in the daily realm. This bill would provide a series of common sense consumer protections that require us to verify age, that would prohibit employees from participating in these contests, and would require us to segregate customer funds from operational funds, as well as a number of other items that are within the bill. And I'd be happy to get into the details of that if there's any questions.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for the benefit of all. In your packets, there is also some written testimony from Paul Charchin, the president of League Safe, an entrepreneur, a small business owner who could not be here today but expressed his desire to provide written testimony on behalf of House File 1415. So I'll just draw that letter to your attention.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I would commend you. One thing that we all have noticed about this bill is a much better author this year. I think most of us remember the bill from last year, most people were on the committee. And I think essentially we're trying to do this to make sure we don't accidentally make fantasy sports illegal. Am I paraphrasing correctly, Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair, you took the words right out of my mouth, and I think I would say yes, and that what we're really trying to do here is provide for a best practices standard for those that are already in this industry within the state of Minnesota, as well as alert those that would want to enter into this industry segment within the state of Minnesota in terms of what we would expect of them.
Thank you. Members, any questions for these testifiers? Otherwise, we got a few more people that want to speak to this bill. Mr. Carlson, do you want to?
No. Mr. Chairman, Joel Carlson. I represent FanDuel and DraftKings, and don't need to provide additional comments. I will point out, though, Mr. Chairman, that that the bill is enlarged from what the House voted upon last year. We've added additional consumer protections like background checks on game operators and other things that were added to the bill after it left the House last year. So the bill is in more robust shape, and we're happy to answer questions about it.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to answer this. My son is a sports savant. He knows every statistic about everything you've ever heard of. He's 16 years old. How are you going to verify that these players are of age?
Whoever wants to, Mr. Hain?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And currently, if somebody joins our site and makes a deposit, they go through, they have to tell us their date of birth. We use a third-party software provider that allows us to use a variety of databases and things like that to guarantee that that person who is entering and depositing money on the site are over the age of 18. And I just point out that currently that's not required under state law in Minnesota, and this bill would require that. And I can get into a little bit more detail, but, again, I'm the government side of things and not the technical side. But if there's any question on our part that the person who is participating is a minor, then we don't allow them to deposit until we're able to verify. And sometimes that requires us to ask for identification and things of that nature.
Thank you. Good question, Representative Rosenthal. Members, any other questions? Not seeing any. We'll go to our next. Oh, Representative Hilstrom.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. If there's more testifiers, I can wait. I just entered the room. I just want to ask a question before the end.
Someone already asked that. Thank you, Representative Hilstrom. There are a lot more testifiers. We'll get to you. Ms. Carla Cinchada. It's going to be just like last week. I get all the names wrong. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your comments.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carla Cincata, and I am the director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Thank you for your time, and I'll be brief. Last year, our division worked with the fantasy sports industry and respective bill authors to address consumer protection and regulatory concerns. Much progress was made. However, some of those consumer protections and regulatory issues from last year have carried forward with this bill introduction. Subsequently, I would request your consideration to these areas. I believe our first concern is more technical in nature. In the bill introduction, the definition could legalize any type of fantasy game or fantasy contest, and that could result in the expansion of internet-based gaming activities outside of just sports. These could include games or contests such as multiplayer video games, prediction games, real-time strategy games, and online battle arena games such as League of Legends or Warcraft. Again, I believe this is technical, and we would work with the authors to address this. Our second area of concern goes back to that definition. In the proposed bill, it defines a fantasy game as a bona fide game of skill. That could negatively impact other areas related to investigations of illegal gambling and lawful gambling fraud. Lastly, our division has concerns related to the implementation of the regulatory provisions of the bill. And that our division is the agency that receives and processes the game operation registrations. We submit and review the results of the criminal background investigations pursuant to the registration process, and we would like that reflected in the language.
Thank you very much. And Representative Albright, I assume you heard and took careful note of those considerations?
Mr. Chair and members, the observations made by the testifier are well known to us, and we continue to work with them to make sure that we find a mutually satisfying outcome.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Members, any questions for this? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the author. Is this going to public safety next, then?
It is, yes.
Thank you.
With that, thank you. Good suggestions, and I look forward to you and Representative Albright working together. Who's next? Mr. Grassel, Jake Grassel. Thought I saw him. There he is. Mr. Grassel, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. Keep it under 20 minutes, I promise. We're here, basically, we wouldn't be here today if this was about the 1 million people playing season-long fantasy sports. We have no concern about that, and I don't think anybody thinks that needs to be regulated. What we're here today is about daily fantasy sports being expansion gambling in the state of Minnesota. I'll make three quick points. One, this isn't fantasy sports as we currently know it. Two, it's not something I believe that can be truly regulated, because by regulating this, we'd be, in effect, creating new or de facto laws on online gaming. And approval of this bill would, corresponding to that, would authorize online gaming for the first time in the history of the state of Minnesota. As was testified over and over last year, on this bill, season-long gaming is vastly different. It has is completely a game of skill that over the course of a season people make corresponding changes based upon a draft. If a player gets hurt, they find the next best available player. In a daily fantasy sports, that's not the case. What happens is you have head-to-head games. People can pick their opponents. They go out, and it brings in a far greater extent of chance, which adding to the wager element that you pay the fee, bring in the chance element, and then the opportunity of a prize are the three components of gambling. If chance wasn't a factor in this, if it was completely skill, the Sharks would win every single game. That's not the case. The marketing isn't the case. FanDuel's, DraftKings, they all are out there telling you you're going to become the next fantasy millionaire. If the middle could never win, which the middle does win, that brings into the element of chance. If the Shark was always winning, this would be bad public policy for Minnesota, because what we would now be doing is creating a marketplace where the unsuspecting consumer, duped by this vast marketing campaigns, telling people they're about to become a fantasy millionaire, would simply be transferring their wealth to these professional sports gamblers. Fantasy sports players. This would be bad public policy. Finally, in the bill you guys passed last year that had made some improvements on the House floor, we find those are lacking this year. There have been some things that have been taken out or redetermined that we think we'd like to work with the author, and the previous testifier commented on a few of those as well. The removal of the no proxy servers from it, and the change in the prohibition of scripts are a huge concern to us on that. Other additional protections that we would like to see from this committee prior to passing the bill, we urge you to not pass the bill, but prohibit professional sports leagues, including any franchises, from owning in whole or part any fantasy sports contest providers, and prohibit esports from the fantasy sports contest definition. That's a huge concern to us, because the allowance for esports, as was testified by the previous testifier, would for sure expand gambling into areas that this bill was never thought of going into.
Thank you, Mr. Grassel. Wait, any questions for this? Not seeing any. Thank you. And Representative Albright, I assume you took note of those concerns as well.
Mr. Chair, copious notes, as well as an understanding that we respect the opinions of those that are testifying in opposition to the bill. However, we do take exception with the fact that this is an expansion of gaming. This has been in existence for some time. And so it merely just provides a specific set of rules which operators must follow in order to continue operating in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Next up is Ms. Ann Krusnick. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Krusnick. I'm here with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is made up of the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Islamic Center of Minnesota, and the Jewish Community Relations Council. So jointly, that represents about 80% of the people of faith in Minnesota. On behalf of those faith communities, we'd really urge you not to move this bill forward. The GRLC historically has opposed any expansion of gambling. Our members, our faith leaders, see over and over again the impact gambling has on individuals and on families. We're particularly concerned about this bill because of the availability of gambling 24 hours a day at work, at home, at school, from a computer, from a cell phone, from an iPad, and have great concern about that. I'd like to make two other just kind of quick points because I want to be brief. The first is I just want to make clear that when you look on line 6.2 to 6.4 of the bill, just to make aware, this isn't automatically geared to huge season-long contests. Or as long as I'm not betting on just one single athlete in one single event, this bill applies. So I just want to make sure that when you're looking at this, that this isn't a season-wide NCAA pool. This is anytime I bet on more than one athlete or on one athlete in more than one event, it's covered by the bill and you're making that lawful. We have particular concern about the impact of this bill on our younger Minnesotans and expect that if the bill passes, that we'll see a significant increase in marketing and promotion really aimed at that targeted audience, and we have real concerns about the social costs of any expansion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krusnick. Members, questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Nice job. Mr. Helmberger from the Family Council. Not seeing Mr. Helmberger coming on. Oh, here he comes. I thought I saw you here. Thank Welcome you, to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm John Helmberger from Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 1415 because it does amount to a substantial expansion of gambling in Minnesota, and especially so by introducing online gambling to the state, something that this legislature has opposed in the past because of the especially dangerous, addictive nature of online gambling. House File 1415 is based on a legal fiction. You've heard a little bit about that already. It's based on a fantasy, pardon the pun, that daily fantasy sports gambling isn't really gambling, but let's be clear, this bill legalizes a growing form of gambling. Daily fantasy sports betting is gambling because it includes the three essential elements of gambling: consideration, prize, and chance. The fact that daily fantasy sports is gambling is understood by those in the gambling industry. The organization Stop Predatory Gambling cites MGM Casino Chairman Jim Murin, who said, "Those who say daily fantasy games aren't gambling are, quote, absolutely, utterly wrong." Close quote. He added, quoting again, "I don't know how to run a football team, but I do know how to run a casino, and this is gambling," end quote. And CEO of the major sports book operator, William Hill, U.S., Joe Ascio said, quoting, "You put up something of value, cash, to win something of value, cash. It's the classic definition of gambling. Any suggestion that fantasy sports is not gambling is the biggest bunch of baloney I've ever seen," end quote. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it must be a duck. Because daily fantasy sports betting is gambling, you have all the problems associated with gambling. It's highly addictive, and daily fantasy sports is no different. That's the reason North Star, a group that helps compulsive gamblers, has opposed daily fantasy sports gambling. Gambling is a predatory business practice that ensures lots of gamblers will lose money. You've heard about that. This form of gambling, online gambling, especially preys on the poor and unsophisticated players who are taken advantage of by the sharks who are experts at winning by designing and using sophisticated algorithms to take other people's money. Experts point out that the ultimate goal of daily fantasy sports is to legalize sports gambling. University of Indianapolis sports marketing professor Lawrence DeGeris states bluntly that, quoting, legalized sports gambling is the end game, close quote. Mark Edelman of Baruch College in New York, affirming the real intent of daily fantasy sports operators, said, quoting, the online platform for daily fantasy sports contests, for the most part, already looks incredibly similar to sports books in casinos, and they were not designed that way by accident, end quote. Finally, daily fantasy sports gambling targets young people for gambling. The Fantasy Sports Trade Association found that almost 10 million fantasy sports players are under 18. This is a huge concern because internet gambling is especially addictive for youth who have grown up playing video games. By deceptively luring youth into online gambling, daily fantasy sports gambling operators are setting up an entire generation of young people to become problem gamblers by making especially exploitative forms of gambling omnipresent in everyday life, whether in their homes or on their smartphones they carry with them everywhere. For all of these reasons, we oppose this bill and its expansion of gambling in Minnesota, and we urge you to vote no.
Mr. Helmberger, thank you. Members, any questions? We are at the end of the people that let us know they were going to testify. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone come down. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the author. I didn't notice any provision to tax this form of fantasy game playing. What is your intention? Maybe I should ask the tax chair who's sitting right next to me. Is it your intention, Representative Davids, after public safety, to take this bill into your committee?
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hillstrom. If there's tax provisions, then yes, we would call for it.
Representative Davids, is it true that the winnings would be taxed?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why I don't play. I'm afraid I'd win too much. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Albright, we actually spoke about this on the House floor. And I know the bill is going to public safety, and I didn't have a chance to talk to anyone about actually drafting some language. But is it your intention that should this bill make it out of this committee and should this bill make it out of public safety, that it would be proper to have some provisions for a tax in this bill?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. Currently, there are no provisions in 1415 that would identify with a reasonable desire to bring it into tax committee, and as such, currently, the businesses that are in the work in this industry are taxpaying enterprises. They pay their taxes. They pay their employees. And so at this juncture, we have no intention to entertain a taxable event by those participating in the online gaming.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I had a meeting with the industry in my office, and it was indicated to me that they may be open to both regulation and taxation. So I guess maybe we'll just have to see if there's an amendment to your bill.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. With that, Representative Albright, we will give you the final word.
Members, I know that we have a number of stops remaining with this, and I look forward to the continuing conversation not only with you but with those that are interested in making the bill as best as it can be. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will leave it up to the committee to urge your support of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Thank you to everybody that testified both for and against the bill. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1415 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Chair,
members.
Chair.
Representative Vogel. House File 740. I will move House File 740 so that it is properly in front of our committee. And we have the Representative Vogel, I've also got an A1 amendment. Is that
okay?
So I will move the, I assume this is an author's amendment?
Yes, it is.
I will move the A1 amendment so that the bill is in the shape you'd like it to be in. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Vogel, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members. Over the years, I've had many conversations with local business people concerning their Main Street businesses. When I was contacted last summer by an auto dealer in my district who expressed concern that his franchisor was not abiding by the requirements of Minnesota's Motor Vehicle Franchise Protection Law, I was very interested and began investigating his concern. I was not familiar with the statute, but came to learn that almost 40 years ago, the legislature recognized the importance of motor vehicle sales to the state's economy and enacted the Motor Vehicle Franchise Protection Law. The law was enacted to protect and preserve the investments and properties of Minnesota citizens involved in motor vehicle sales, because then, as is the case now, local auto dealers don't have nearly the resources and economic power as their franchisors, who are the larger auto companies. The majority of Minnesota's auto dealers, like the ones in my district, are family-owned, single-point stores that have been operating in their communities for many generations. To ensure their long-term viability, they have invested significantly in their property, inventory, and employees, knowing it is their responsibility as a well-run business to do so. However, lately they have been faced with a shifting landscape since the manufacturer's payments for warranty work have been less than comparable to the work they do for customers, and costs related to facility improvements are often more than they can afford relative to their size of operation. Locally owned and operated businesses form the heart of Main Street in communities across our state and can be counted on to provide both leadership and funding for local needs and projects. It is vitally important more than ever to keep that support alive and well. I believe there is a role for us as legislators to play in ensuring the law encourages policies that will keep small business thriving in Minnesota. For that reason, I bring forward House File 740, which is intended to keep a level playing field, so both the auto manufacturers and the local dealers have rules commensurate with fair reimbursement and transparency in the relationship they share together. I also have some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Ms. Backus, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Amber Backus with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. I'm here on behalf of our 370 franchise new car and truck dealers located across the state. I did want to point out a packet you should have received that talks a little bit about our economic contributions to the state, as well as a letter from the Machinists Union in support of the bill. You should know the Teamsters also support the bill. They weren't able to submit a letter in time for today's hearing. And then the last letter is from the Global Automakers, one of the factory trade associations, and they are in agreement with the provisions in Section 2 of the bill related to stop sales. But I would like to say, Mr. Chair and members, if manufacturers were following the law as it currently stands, we wouldn't be here today. Existing law in ADE.041 says the reimbursement for warranty services shall not be less than the rate charged by the dealer for like service to non-warranty customers for non-warranty service and repairs. Unfortunately, our member dealerships have seen that reimbursement rate erode over the past few years. In a survey of MADA service directors, only 17% thought they were being treated fairly by the manufacturer when it comes to warranty reimbursement. 86% receive compensation for parts that is below their customer pay jobs, and over one-third of those at rates at less than 40% of customer pay. For labor, 93% receive compensation for labor that is below their customer pay jobs, again, with over one-third at rates less than 40% of customer pay jobs. 90% of the respondents have been denied a warranty claim or charged back due to a minor clerical error, and over 80% have seen the cost of a part depressed when it is suddenly part of a recall. Through this bill, we hope to provide more specificity, as 26 other states already do, so the erosion of the reimbursement rate for warranty work stops and our dealers are paid what is already required under the law, without opportunities for the manufacturers to deny payment because of clerical errors or to take money on the front end by putting a surcharge on the price they charge dealers for vehicles. As we looked to solutions to address the underpayment of dealers on warranty work, it elicited a bigger discussion on instances where the manufacturers are not treating their franchise dealers fairly. In Section 2, our goal is to keep dealers whole in the event their manufacturer demands they stop selling used vehicles with an open recall that doesn't pose a threat to the vehicle's safety or operations. When a stop sale is ordered, our dealers are left paying interest and incurring storage costs on vehicles they cannot sell, while the competitor down the street, who has the same vehicle in its inventory, can sell it without any restrictions since they are not bound by the franchise agreement. These stop sales also hurt consumers as they diminish the value of vehicles for trade-in. After reaching an agreement with the 12 manufacturers who comprise global automakers and encompass almost 40% of the Minnesota market, we are proposing dealers subject to a stop sale order be compensated at a prorated rate of 1.75% the trade-in value of the vehicle, and that agreement is reflected in the author's amendment A1. In Section 3, we have reached agreement with the Alliance on defining objective terms they can use when rejecting a non-familiar successor to a dealer, and those changes are also reflected in the A1 amendment. In Section 4, we would like to reinforce that the factories treat dealers fairly and apply programs and performance standards uniformly, as already required by law. Dealers are judged by the factories on their sales effectiveness, yet the factories can manipulate the factors used to make that judgment. To discourage bias, on page 9 of the bill, we want dealers to be able to see how a factory arrives at the sales targets and metrics it uses to both evaluate and pay a dealer. Therefore, we are asking that the manufacturers, upon request, provide the formula used to arrive at those numbers for the requesting dealer and any of its competitors of the same line make within 75 miles. This language is identical to a North Carolina provision that was enacted in 2001. Similarly, the manufacturer controls defining the sales area in which a dealer is judged to be sales effective. To prohibit gerrymandering of the boundaries that can work against a dealer, we are asking that any changes to the sales area consider the pattern of vehicle sales within a market and other factors like population and geographic obstacles that could influence those patterns. This provision, too, was borrowed from North Carolina law and was further amended in the A1 amendment to address concerns from the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. And lastly, our dealers are fiercely loyal to the brands they represent and willing to present those brands in the best light possible. However, there are limits on their financial resources to be able to do so. On page 12, as amended in the author's amendment, we hope to limit the manufacturers from requiring costly building and rebranding of image elements more frequently than every 10 years. These projects can run into the hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars. Many of our dealers have recently undertaken major remodeling projects to comply with factory image programs, and it's not always easy. We did have a dealer have to fight tooth and nail not to be required to put in porcelain exterior sidewalks around its dealership in Minnesota. But they are already being asked to make adjustments because the automakers have come up with new image standards. Our dealers want to be fiscally responsible and pay off the first round of improvements before being asked to take on more debt. We know the manufacturers have concerns over the bill brought forward today. The A1 amendment is a first step in addressing those concerns, and we are willing to continue the conversation and get to a place where they are more comfortable with the bill. That being said, we are not willing to make changes that will undermine the effect of the bill and allow the manufacturers to continue to use their significant economic leverage to disregard their obligations under the current law and shift their costs to our dealers, especially when some of them just had record annual profits of $12.5 billion this year. We do hope you will stand with your local dealers and their 20,000 employees across the state to move forward these updates to the franchise law that will provide their businesses more predictability in their operations and promote a healthy dealer network that affords Minnesota consumers price competition, convenience, and choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Members, any questions for the author or first testifier? We've got four more testifiers listed. Why don't we jump right into that? Mr. Dave Melling from Invergrove Hyundai. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Dave Mealing. I'm the Parts and Service Director at Invergrove Hyundai. Our dealership sells about 1,700 vehicles a year, generating $1.3 million in motor vehicle sales taxes alone. Additionally, we employ 60 Minnesotans, including 11 union employees in our service center. I'd like to speak specifically to Section 1 of the bill, which deals with warranty reimbursements. As you've already heard, under the current law, manufacturers are supposed to be paying us for parts and labor rates not less than what we charge retail customers for the same service. That is not what's happening today. About 27% of the work we do in our shop is warranty work, and on average, at a minimum, I'm receiving about 33% less on labor than we do for our customer pay jobs. The difference is particularly disheartening to our union technicians. Hyundai and other manufacturers require that our most experienced technicians with special certifications perform warranty work. Accordingly, these mechanics that do that, that have those certifications, are also the highest paid in our shops. However, because the manufacturer depresses the time allowed to perform the warranty work versus the actual time to pay the jobs for the techs, we do about four of these a week, their checks are substantially less than if they were doing customer pay work. This disparity demoralizes our most valuable employees, and the factory creates a disincentive for them to want to work on warranty repairs. In the modern world, we don't have big books and catalogs anymore, but our warranty policy and procedure manual I would like to bring in to show you how thick it is. But it's 227 pages long. 45 pages alone explain how to file a warranty claim. As Amber alluded to earlier about the clerical errors and things that we can get involved in, if we make a simple mistake of $1 on a $3,000 bill, we lose the whole $3,000, not the dollar. I ask you please vote on House File 740 so our techs can get paid fairly for the work that they are doing. Could you imagine if I hired you and said, I'm going to pay you $15 an hour to work around your house, but I'm only going to pay you for 15 minutes for every hour you work? Essentially, that's what the factory is doing to our technicians. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. time. Milling. Nice job. Members, any questions? Mr. Yang.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Mr. Yang, I'm going to interrupt you right at the start. Very nice job coming down together. Good job. We're trying to save time here. You're my favorite testifier so far today. Nice work.
Thank you again. My name is Van Yang, and I work with Dave as the parts manager at Invergo Hyundai. I am responsible for about 11,500 parts worth $256,000, and we buy a majority of our parts from our Hyundai or its authorized a distributor, and then Hyundai sets the price for what we pay for them. A couple of weeks past, I was here at the MADA at the Capitol and spoke to my legislator about the bill. He was frustrated that he had a part subject to a recall on his vehicle that broke and caused additional damage. He was upset the dealership that he went to didn't pay to fix the secondary part that broke. I'm sure that dealership that he went to would have liked to accommodate him, but in this situation, the dealership in particular was already taking a loss on the recall repair. They would have to eat this entire cost of the second, which maybe they wanted to do, but they have no margin to allow them to. If the factories were paying the dealership at retail rates for parts and labor, which they are required to under the current law, that dealership and all dealerships could better serve our customers. Again, I ask you to vote yes on House File 740. Thank you.
Mr. Yang, Mr. Milling, thank you. Members, any questions for either of these two gentlemen? See none, thank you, gentlemen. Next, Mr. David Bright. We're going to have a tie for my favorite testifier. quick on the uptake. We like that.
Indeed.
Mr. Bright, Mr. Perry, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is David Bright. I'm an attorney with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The Alliance is a trade association that represents 12 manufacturers of cars and light trucks. Combined, they produce roughly 70% of all the automobiles sold in the United States every year. Thank you for the time to be here today and voice the Alliance's opposition to HF 740. In the interest of the committee's time, I will discuss Section 2 of the bill and yield the floor to my co-panelist, Jeffrey Perry. I would like to state at the outset that it's important to note that when it comes to the manufacturer-dealer relationship, the only way that manufacturers can sell their product is through the dealers. If the dealers do not succeed, then we do not succeed. It is in our interest to make sure that the dealers are successful. Now, having said that, I'll jump into Section 2, which covers required payments under stop sale directive for recalls. But I think it might help to provide a little bit of context for this issue. The way it works under federal recall law is that when a manufacturer decides to do a recall, it must announce it, and then it gets the parts. Federal law does not allow a manufacturer to realize a recall is necessary, stockpile the parts, and then announce the recall. Now, as a result of that, there are going to be times when there are delays in getting parts or remedies that are necessary to fix these cars out to the dealers. And sometimes the manufacturer may instruct the dealer not to sell a used vehicle that is under recall while it's in the dealer's inventory, which begs the question of how much a manufacturer should compensate that dealer, and that's what Section 2 is getting down to. Now, Section 2, as Ms. Backhouse testified, requires the manufacturer to pay 1.75% of the value of that used car per month. But if you do the math, that works out to be 21% per year on that used car. Simply stated, that doesn't pass the laugh test. That is an astounding number. Indeed, there are a few investments that return 21% per year. The Alliance has attempted to discuss this number with the dealers, and we simply cannot figure out where this number comes from, what the support for that number is. Instead, the Alliance has offered a generous yet more reasonable 1% per month, which translates into 12% per year. Again, the goal for this section is to make the dealers whole. It's not to create a windfall profit for the dealers. We believe that 12% a year is much more in line with making the dealers whole, not creating that windfall, and not unreasonably driving up costs to both the manufacturers and the consumers. I should also add that that 12% number is in line with what the federal government does in its law regarding recalls on new vehicles. It's also in line with what the only two states that have enacted legislation on this do. They both say 1%, a.k.a. 12% per year, in their statutes. Finally, there are three other states with which the Alliance and the local dealer association have reached an agreement on for legislation in those states, again, all using that 1% per month, 12% per year number. Now, going forward, the Alliance would very much like to continue working with the Minnesota automobile dealers. This is a controversial bill. It involves many more subjects than just the one that I've testified on today. But again, in the interest of your time, we wanted to give you a highlight of some of the key issues here. Now, lest I take up any more of the committee's time, I'll yield the floor to my co-panelist, at which point I'll be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Mr. Bright, thank you very much. Mr. Perry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As my colleague said, my name is Jeff Perry. I'm with Director of Public Policy for General Motors. I'm here to talk today about House File 740. And as I think is quite obvious as you've read the bill in front of you, House File 740 seeks to make some sweeping changes to establish contractual relationships between manufacturers and dealers. And while the Minnesota Dealer Association has indicated that there are many provisions in this bill that cover areas of law that have been addressed in many other states, what they've not said is that the proposals they've chosen for this bill are not based on common language used in the majority of those states. In fact, there are cherry-picked sections that choose the worst of the worst language in order to, quote, put screws to the manufacturers. And in our conversations with them, we have not outright said, no, we do not want any of these provisions. In fact, what we've said is we've offered back language in every single one of those that is consistent with the majority positions in these other states. Now, since our first conversation and just prior to this, I do want to acknowledge, as you're all aware, there has been an amendment to the bill. I have not read that. That was just shown to me I think about at the same time that most of you had seen it. So I think there are some changes in there that address some of the smaller issues. I'm certain that the issues relative to the warranty reimbursement, especially on the labor reimbursement language, is not addressed, and neither is the language relative to the used vehicle recall compensation language. At the very core, this bill offends the very nature of the manufacturer dealer's franchise relationships. Our relationship is built upon a mutual give and take where each party has agreed to meet certain obligations in exchange for other consideration. The manufacturer provides the dealer with vehicles and parts at discounted prices below MSRP, and then the dealer takes advantage of that discount in order to build a profitable retail business. In exchange, the dealer commits to promoting the manufacturer's products and providing warranty service for the manufacturer at volume discounted rates. All of these terms are agreed to in advance when the dealer approaches the manufacturer as a candidate to become a franchise dealer, and those terms are all understood at the time that they enter into the agreement. I understand that the Minnesota law may currently say that retail reimbursement is required for warranty payments. What the current law does not state, though, is any sort of a formula or process to do that. And some of the language that's been proposed in this bill covers that formula and that process. That portion of the bill is what we've agreed to with the dealers and said that's the kind of language that other states have taken on. We're willing to work with you on that language. But the language that sort of that offends our position is that on the labor reimbursement section, they have chosen a formula that only one other state in the nation has chosen to use. And I will point out that state did not prohibit cost recovery when they did it. So in effect, what that language does is it takes the customer's repair order. So when a customer brings a vehicle in outside of their warranty for a customer pay retail repair and they have a repair done, this language sets up a formula or a process where they then submit 100 of those types of repairs to us, customer paid repairs. We take that that information and we calculate what was the total amount paid by these customers. And in 38 other states that have this language, you divide that by the total hours on those repair orders, so the actual hours that were charged to the customer. What their language does is it takes the total amount paid by those customers and then divides it by a completely separate number that appears in our labor time guides. Now, why is there a difference between the two time guides? The reason is that our time guides are actually time-based studies. We base every one of the repairs in the time guide on an actual study done in an actual garage with manual hand tools, as opposed to the tools the dealers are able to use, which are power tools. And when we are finished with that calculation of time, we add a blanket 20% increase to that to account for bathroom breaks, walking to get a manual, walking to get parts, taking parts out of packages, that sort of thing. The aftermarket time guides that are used for customer repair orders after the warranty, those manuals are actually created by aftermarket suppliers buying our time guides and simply adding more time to them. They don't do a time study. They add a blanket amount across the board. It's usually somewhere between a 20 and 30% increase on top of our amounts with no time study. And at the front of those manuals, they generally indicate that these manuals are not intended for use on vehicles under a manufacturer's warranty and are primarily intended for use by an independent repair shop. The reason for that is independent repair shops are less familiar with individual vehicles of a certain make. They tend to see a broader make of vehicles, and so the technician is expected to need more time. In addition, the technicians aren't always as highly qualified as they are at an authorized repair service center for a manufacturer. So in all of these circumstances, that adds time and expense for the dealer, and so the aftermarket time guides allow a bump up for out-of-warranty repairs. So all we're saying in our response back to the dealer association is we agree it will be very helpful to have a process in place. A 100 repair order process is what we typically refer to it as. It's been adopted in 38 other states, and that's the language that should be used. The language that Wisconsin uses is not the model. It's the only state in the country that's using it. And in this point in time, there, it's actually under litigation because of some of the problems that it's causing with between the manufacturers and the dealers. So my colleague, Dave, has already talked about the used vehicle language, so I will just finish up by pointing out there are a couple other items in here. And Amber and Scott, I apologize again. I haven't read and put all your pieces together, so if this part's off, I apologize. But at my last review of the bill, House File 740 also forces a manufacturer to reveal proprietary information in order to administer our incentive programs, including the business information about competing dealerships. This is the language that was referred to initially as coming out of North Carolina. And while North Carolina does have language similar to that, we had an extensive conversation with the state of North Carolina when they put that language in place and cautioned them that by putting that in place, we may need to cancel dealer programs because it is against our corporate policy, privacy policies, to share business information among dealers without direct consent from those dealers. This language actually requires me to share another dealer's information with a competing dealer, and we're simply not going to do that. So if that language stands, the likelihood is that we will have to cancel programs in the state that many dealers find to be very lucrative and profitable for their businesses. In addition, it also says that if a manufacturer is not willing to provide this, it is presumed to be unreasonable and cause irreparable harm and injury to the inquiring dealer. So essentially, this allows one single disgruntled dealer to shut down an entire incentive program on the threat of obtaining private information about his competitors simply because the program's not working for that dealer. Even if all of the other dealers in the state like the program, find it to be helpful and profitable for them. In all likelihood, if a single dealer is objecting to it, that dealer is probably just not performing that well, and the program never would have helped them under any circumstances. Now, despite all these disagreements, as I indicated, every provision of this bill, we've attempted to reach some compromise. We've developed alternatives in a very short period of time that match what the majority of states are doing on each and every one of these sections. And we are still hopeful. In fact, I think we're going to try to speak right after this that the Dealers Association and the manufacturers will come to some agreements here, that they'll be able to accept most of the provisions that we've offered back, and we do look forward to those continued discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Members, any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You testified that the Wisconsin law made it so that you might have to cancel programming and said that if we made it similar, we might have to cancel some incentive programming here. Can you tell me, have you actually canceled any incentive programming in the state of Wisconsin since that law has passed?
Mr. Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was actually North Carolina.
North Carolina.
But, yes. And, yes, we have had to look at some programs and roll back some programs in North Carolina, and shortly after we did that, they did make some changes to their law, and we were able to reinstate those.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There also was some testimony. I'm sorry, I forgot your name, the first testifier. There was
Mr.
also
Brighton.
Some testimony that a 1% is a better number. Can you tell me, does the cars that you're making them hold depreciate less than 1% while they're being held? Or would it be better language that you had to reimburse them for any amount that the vehicles actually depreciated while you held it?
Mr. Bright.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 1% number is designed to account for that depreciation. Rather than a dealer needing to calculate a reimbursement rate for every single car in its inventory, which would be an administrative nightmare for both the dealer and the manufacturer, the 1% number is aimed at compensating the dealer for not just the depreciation cost, but also the storage cost. So, again, we've considered that, and that's part of the 1% number.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you be open to a 1% or whichever is greater number to be added to the bill in the event you like the 1% number better?
Mr. Bright or Representative Vogel or Mr. Perry, anybody want to take that one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one, I would need to see that in writing, but two, I'm skeptical of that approach. I again think that the 1% number is calculated to meet the average dealer's needs, and also not to overburden the manufacturer in its attempt to make the dealer whole.
Representative
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've never owned a car that's only depreciated 1% in a month, Mr. Chair, but I would love to own one of those.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, thank you. Members, other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the provisions that are proposed by the dealers, some of them go to unfair practices, and so it seems appropriate for the legislature to weigh in on that. There's some standards regarding that protection, sort of, but some of these other provisions seem to be. I mean, what can you identify? Either side identify provisions that are really provisions that just can't be negotiated. I mean, are they business interests that really talking about economic interests, and should the legislature be weighing in on those? Can you explain, give me an example of one of the provisions where you can summarize the economic interests and why there's opposition?
And Representative Allen, I apologize. I didn't, whoever wants to take it, I didn't catch who you asked the question of. I'm sorry.
Either side. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the warranty reimbursement section is an example of an economic situation that is really best suited to the contractual terms. Now, I say that understanding that the law already has certain language in it, and to that extent, I think the process piece of it, where we're saying, you know, how do we determine what this amount is, submit 100 repairers, that's where we've tried to meet with some compromise with the dealers and say, this is the language that's used in 38 other states. We're willing to go this far with you. I think in terms of the actual discussions over the compensations that the dealers do or don't get, that really comes down to enforcement of a contract. And if the dealers don't feel that the law is being upheld by the manufacturers, it's not for the legislature to take that on and get in between that battle. The legislature's already done its job. It's already put the law into place. The dealers need to be, if they feel they've been wrong, they need to be enforcing their rights through court.
Representative Allen, follow up.
No.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a situation that it's a tough one. I'm supporting the Vogel bill today because I think that the discussion needs to go on. I mean, you've got two groups here that I love both of them. I love the manufacturers, and I love the dealers. I love them both. I think the dealers might have come in a bit aggressive, and I thank you, Everson Vogel, for that amendment, and I'm hoping discussions can move forward in a very positive manner. I think some things need to be done here. I think your bill addresses those. But I hope that the manufacturers and the dealers can get together and achieve true peace in the valley. I do have one question for the gentleman from GM. When is General Motors going to upgrade their Silverados to military-grade aluminum? I just hope that we can come together because we got two groups that we respect and love dearly, and I think some things need to be done in the Vogel bill. On the other hand, like I said, I do thank you for working, and I hope discussions continue right after this meeting and continue until we see white smoke pumping out of the chimney of the state office building.
Representative Davids, I think you have fulfilled your role on this committee as our senior member very well and expressed the feelings and desires of, I think, members on both sides of the aisle. I haven't talked to every single member, but talking to a number of members, we like peace in the valley. We like compromise. We're glad this is still a work in the progress. We're going to vote Representative Vogel's bill out of here today, but I think there is still work to be done. And when we hear, as legislators, it makes us very nervous when we hear that things are only done in one other state. We only want to be number one in one thing, and that's being the best state, and we've already done that, so we don't need anything else. So Representative Davids, well said. Representative Vogel, we'll give you the final word on your bill.
Well, I, I do thank you for all of the listening and the discussions. Attempts to obviously be a fairly technical bill. There's a lot of verbiage in here to try to define things that are sometimes difficult to define. So I agree that it is a work in progress. I know there's conversations that are continuing. I'd encourage those because at the end of the day, like I said, what interested me about this was I've been a small business person on Main Street, and it's really important that we have the balance of some legislation that allows the dealers to be profitable, but yet, again, recognizing that if they don't have anything to sell because the it's too one-sided, that doesn't work either. So I appreciate the conversation, and we'll continue.
Representative Wogel, well said. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 740, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, thank you for a good discussion. Representative Vogel, nice work. Representative O'Driscoll, try and top that.
Well, Mr. Chair, in Vaudeville, they say don't follow the Dog Act, the Kids Act, and apparently the Auto Act either. So,
well, Representative, you have something they don't have, they didn't have. And as Representative Vogel, do you want to move House File 1377?
I'm Representative O'Driscoll, but I'm sure if Representative Vogel was on this committee, he'd be happy
sorry
to do that.
Why don't we move on to the next bill? Representative O'Driscoll, why don't you go ahead and move House File 1377?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I move House File 1377.
And here's what you have that Representative Vogel did not have. You have an A2 amendment. I assume that's an author's amendment?
I do, and I'd like to move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I like, Mr. Chair.
Members, let's go ahead and vote on this, adopting this amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape the author would like it to be in. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make some brief comments. Maybe have some testifiers on both sides of the issue today who will articulate their thoughts on this. The bill before us today deals with an acronym called PACE, P-A-C-E, which stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy Loans. In the state of Minnesota, we have allowed for PACE-type loans and financing to be used in commercial and industrial, and it's been working reasonably well in that area. The issue that we have is it's also allowed in residential, and because in the business that I'm in, I talk about the wolf, the sheep, and the shepherd being the Department of Commerce that keeps the sheep and the wolves working together in the industry. And the consumers are the ones who are the sheep that could be taken advantage of. And not to say that any particular business or industry is a predator, but the idea being that the wolf is something that kind of helps put that scenario together. And the wolf is anybody who knows more than the consumer does about what the, what's happening in the negotiations of the transaction. And so what we're looking to do with this bill, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is to take the residential PACE offline, put a working group together to work through some of the issues that might affect consumers in the way of disclosures, in the way of full vetting and understanding how these may end up affecting individual property owners. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to just go through and just give a scenario for folks. Let's assume that a first-time home buyer would like to go out and purchase a home that needs some renovation, and they would pick up the phone, call a contractor, and have that contractor come out and do some work on the property. Under Minnesota state law, the way things work right now, the first priority lien that would be on that property would most likely be the mortgage lien. That the individual was having some work done on the property and asked to have a contractor come out and do some work, and in the unlikely event that that contractor wasn't paid, they would be able to file a mechanics lien under Minnesota Statute 514. And in the event that we were to go forward with PACE loans, the way the Minnesota lien law works, property tax liens and special assessment liens immediately go ahead of that mortgage lien and the mechanics lien that would be on that property, regardless of when they were filed. With the PACE loans, it allows communities to be able to form organizations, make loans to individuals, and then add that to their special assessments through taxes. That loan, that mortgage lien would stay second, and so would the mechanics lien stay second to the property tax and special assessment lien. The concerns that I have as the author on this bill, and I'm sure you're going to hear from other folks who are testifying today, that should that property lose value, the special assessment lien on the property remains, and that we could have a situation where the lender, to preserve their needs and value on the property, would feel obligated to pay the taxes and special assessments, thus making that loan even more complex. Mr. Chair, I'm probably already in about 50,000 feet of water for most people on this. So at this time, what I'd like to do is I'd like to turn it over to some of the folks in the industry on both sides to share their thoughts with the committee.
Representative O'Driscoll, you had us with the parable on the lion and the lamb and whatever that was. Mr. Egger, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Egger. I'm representing the Minnesota Realtors Association, and our members are the 18,000 realtors across Minnesota. Before I get started, you should have two handouts from the supporters of this bill. There's one that has a number of logos at the bottom of the Realtors, Minnesota Bankers Association, Legal Aid, and Center for Energy and Environment. And there's also an article from the Wall Street Journal that you can't miss. It has a Wall Street Journal across the top of it. Just want to call your attention to those items. We're here today, Mr. Chair, in support of Representative O'Driscoll's House File 1377. We do agree with a number of the other stakeholders you're going to hear from today that Minnesota needs to develop and implement consumer protection measures before residential PACE loans are made available to Minnesota homeowners for financing energy improvements. Now, what this bill does is it creates a Department of Commerce-led stakeholder process that will allow for a thoughtful and deliberate discussion of the PACE-related issues homeowners need to understand before determining if this type of financing makes sense for them. Realtors are concerned about the problems that California homeowners encountered over the past couple of years when residential PACE programs became available in that state. We have an opportunity to avoid that same experience here with this bill. Homeowners need to understand both the benefits and the risks of PACE financing. Where an energy efficiency project is financed by adding an assessment to a homeowner's property tax bill that is paid back over time. If homeowners are not well informed at the time they take out a PACE loan, they may be frustrated and surprised by a number of things, including potentially the amount their property taxes are increased to pay back the loan, potential delays or even cancellations when they want to sell their home due to a buyer's unwillingness to assume responsibility for paying back the PACE loan, which is attached to the property, and also that the PACE lien takes first position, which Representative O'Driscoll mentioned and which you'll hear more about from the Minnesota Bankers Association. We do support the stakeholder process in this bill so that the Department of Commerce and all interested parties can think through and recommend to the legislature next session the consumer protections that Minnesota homeowners deserve. Without this legislation, we are concerned that realtors will often be left explaining to homeowners trying to sell their homes with PACE loans attached what they should have been adequately informed of and consented to up front when they took out the loan. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. And members, this is the other 77. So if you didn't find the handouts that Mr. Egger was referencing, they were in 1477 instead of 1377. So if anybody needs them, I have extra. I apologize for that. And with that, Mr. Elwood, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I think all stakeholders in this process are in agreement with the ultimate goal, and that is to PACE to move forward. It must do so with the appropriate and sufficient consumer protections in place. There is, as you've seen, substantial and credible evidence of problems with residential PACE in California. A significant concern in particular of ours is at its core, this is equity-based lending, which has really not been terribly beneficial for our clients in the past. It's a loan, but it doesn't have any of the lending protections of a traditional loan. And while we support the goals of PACE, we believe the proper approach to ensuring that the program does move forward safely is to go through the stakeholder process to develop the necessary protections for homeowners and for the real estate market around PACE lending. You know, a large part of my career here in Legal Aid and here at the Capitol has been spent trying to close the proverbial barn after the horse has left and the financial mess is left behind. And on this one, I think we can prevent the problems before they occur. This is a relatively new and complex program, and we're learning more about it every day. We believe our approach, the deliberative approach that we're taking to determine under what rules PACE should move forward, is the right one. I think we should take the time to get it right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Ms. Kuvas. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Teresa Kubas. I work for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The MBA represents 95% of the banks in Minnesota. We agree with Mr. Ager and Mr. Elwood on the need to create a stakeholder group that pulls all the interested parties together to discuss and provide recommendations on how to proceed in Minnesota with PACE. I am not going to repeat everything that has already been stated, though we do agree on many of the issues already mentioned. I'm going to touch on the mortgage and the concerns that PACE financing has on a home. The Federal Housing Finance Agency has directed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that they should neither purchase nor refinance mortgages with PACE loans attached. This policy then results in restrictions placed on PACE borrowers. If the PACE borrower wants to refinance or sell to a conventional borrower, they will have to pay the PACE loan in full. At this time, Fannie and Freddie cover about 50% of the mortgages in the market. The FHFA policy makes sense for two reasons. First, the first lien position, or super lien, of the PACE loan. Unlike personal debt, PACE debt runs with the land and not the borrower. The default will follow the property and all future owners until it is paid in full. Second, the financing structure creates additional risk for the mortgagee. PACE loans create a retroactive liability on a property ahead of the existing first lien mortgage, which the mortgage holder neither knows about nor consents to. The lender has no knowledge and no say in the subsequent additional risk. Further, the risk is enhanced because PACE loans require minimal underwriting, whereas the majority of conventional mortgagees must document the ability to repay. The enhanced risk matters to lenders because of their investment in the property. In addition to all the consumer protection concerns, this is one that would be discussed in a stakeholder process. We support this approach, and we have the opportunity in Minnesota to get all the consumer protections and concerns addressed before it is fully implemented. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kubas. Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Sullivan. I'm the manager of strategic relations for the Center for Energy and Environment. CEE is an almost 40-year-old energy efficiency nonprofit based in the Twin Cities. We work throughout the state with utilities, businesses, and individuals to reduce energy waste, help people save money, make their businesses more competitive and their homes more comfortable. CEE designs and implements efficiency programs for utilities. We provide low interest financing to businesses and individuals, and we do original research into efficiency issues, and we work with policymakers to advance efficiency. Before discussing PACE, I think it's important for the committee to understand a couple basics about efficiency. Minnesota's utilities have been operating electric and gas efficiency programs and savings for more than 30 years. Today, if we aggregate all of our efficiency programs and savings together, the data shows that we save approximately 8.5 million megawatt hours of electricity per year. To put that number into context, that's about 14% of our electric system. So we save more than twice as many megawatt hours through our programs than we generate from natural gas. And this is important because efficiency is the lowest cost resource for the system. It costs on average 2 cents to save a kilowatt hour versus 8 cents to generate one. And Minnesotans have saved roughly $6 billion over the years through our efficiency programs. So what this tells you is that efficiency programs have been operating successfully in Minnesota for years. There's no silver bullet to these programs. It's just hard work and kind of putting your shoulder into it. So our organization lives and breathes efficiency, and this is why we support Representative Driscoll's House File 1377, and the reason that we want to ensure there are adequate consumer protections for residential PACE is because there is a danger to all clean energy programs and providers when clean energy programs are not designed well and don't protect consumers. So PACE is a financing tool proponents argue unlocks a huge new market for home energy improvements. That may be, but our concern is that it is possible to lose one's home due to defaulting on a residential PACE loan, and people will not appreciate this risk since there are inadequate statutory consumer protections in place around residential PACE today. It's a secured home loan in the guise of a tax lien, and tax liens are not subject to the suite of consumer protections that are imposed on other financing mechanisms where homeowners can lose their home in the case of a default. In our opinion, these basic consumer protections should include adequate and timely disclosure of all costs and fees under a residential PACE loan, adequate underwriting criteria to make sure a homeowner has the ability to pay back the loan, unique protections necessary for the elderly and low-income homeowners and other financially vulnerable homeowners, the ability to cancel a loan if a homeowner changes their mind, and protections against contractor kickbacks and the like. So as has been testified to already, California has been a major market for residential PACE loans for more than 5 years. And the PACE program has been utilized in California. And as it's been utilized in California, a number of consumer protection issues have come up. There are at least 3 class action lawsuits pending alleging consumer abuse, and the California legislature recently scrambled to enact consumer protections for residential PACE and will likely work on more in the future. So we would like to avoid a California-like situation in Minnesota and set consumer protections in place prior to residential PACE taking off here. No one is currently operating a PACE program, a residential PACE program in Minnesota, so no one will be harmed by taking our time to do this right. We think that House File 1377 provides the appropriate time and process to protect Minnesotans from the problems that Californians have experienced. And from our perspective, this is a measure twice, cut once piece of legislation. So thank you for your time, and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Sullivan, I have a quick question. Could you run over that 14% number, the percent that we save by saving instead of?
Sure. If you look at all of the megawatt hours, this is on the electric side, this is not on the gas side. If you look at all of the megawatt hours that are generated and consumed in Minnesota, we generate about, or we use about 67 million megawatt hours of electricity per year. If you were to add into that the megawatt hours that we save but are not included in that calculation, we save about 8.5 million megawatt hours on top of that. So if you then reconstruct a new pie chart, that's how you get the 14% number.
And that's from conservation primarily?
That is from conservation. That is from efficiency-driven programs like lighting programs, like programs for rooftop units, industrial. So,
plugging stuff in at your neighbor's house with a long extension cord.
Exactly. Another number that maybe to help Minnesota, the third largest source of electricity in Minnesota right now is wind energy.
Right.
And that's about 9 million megawatt hours are generated from wind. So efficiency is just a little bit less than that number.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Not seeing any questions. Ms. Padilla.
Thank you.
Ms. Padilla, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Julie Padilla, Regional Director of Market Expansion and Policy for Renovate America. I think I'm the wolf or the horse in the comparisons that have been made so far. So,
Ms. Padilla, none of us understood what he was saying either. So,
not sure I did either, but
I saw a burning bush. I don't know. Ms. Padilla.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you. Representative Orchisco, for bringing this legislation. I think this is a really important conversation to have. Renovate America is the leading residential PACE provider nationally. We currently operate in California, Missouri, and there's another residential PACE program in Florida, which we will be joining in the next several months. We have to date improved close to 91,000 homes, invested $2.1 billion in energy efficiency and renewable improvements on those homes, with an economic impact of close to $4 billion and the creation of over 18,000 jobs. We are a private company that brings private capital and software solutions into a public-private partnership to create a scalable residential PACE program in the local governments that choose to allow us to enter. And that's a really important point. I mean, I think this conversation about statutory protections is critical. But to date, PACE has been growing as an industry and learning as an industry with the express permission of the local governments where we operate. We cannot start a business in any state without a local government allowing us to enter. So there's that relationship that has to happen. And with the adoption of an ordinance, they can ask us to leave their community. So for us, operating in over 500 communities to date without having any of them ask us to leave, that's really a critical piece for us. We are as invested in consumer protections as anyone who has been up at this table so far. So when we started looking at Minnesota as a potential marketplace, we looked at the statute, which currently allows for residential PACE to operate here. And then we actually reached out to the Department of Commerce to pull a stakeholder group together, because for us, this is very important to have these relationships in place and make sure that as we enter a market, we are meeting the consumer protection needs of local governments and stakeholders. So that process started in late 2015. We've had a number of meetings. But during that time, to be fair to the other side and to be fair to the comments that have been made, the industry has really been continuing to evolve. There have been some negative press stories. There have been many more positive press stories. But there's a lot of tension about how PACE as an industry should grow and change. Over the last 12 months, we've seen the FHA and VA and HUD endorse PACE as a priority lien, noting that in the event of a default, only the portion that is in arrears actually comes before that mortgage. We've seen the Department of Energy and our National Industry Association come out with consumer protections to push ahead good and new guidance for the states that we operate in. And California has been leading the way on actually adopting statutory protections, which we would like to see happen in Minnesota as well. I provided a few handouts that I think are relevant to this conversation. One is the Morningstar ABS research document, which really kind of runs counter to what you see in the Wall Street Journal article. Morningstar, if you're not familiar with them, does research qualitative and quantitative on investments, and they are really the industry leader in analyzing those investments. And they really go through in this document some of the misconceptions about PACE. I find this one to be really helpful. If you can take a look here, I just want to be clear that while we are happy to have a stakeholder process and we want to make sure that the right consumer protections are in statute, we have not been remiss as a company or an industry in determining that consumers should come first in this process. So this document reflects what we do currently, how we compare to existing products on the marketplace. And on the flip side of that, you'll see the additional enhanced care and protections we have for seniors in place. You also have a 51-page document in front of you that is the existing consumer protections that our industry has in place, recently published by our National Association. And we are working with partners in every state to determine, either at the programmatic level or at the state level, how best to incorporate these into statute or into policy. So I think, you know, we are much closer than maybe the assumptions might be made about where we are as a group on determining how to move ahead. I think we can address the issues that are raised in the bill, certainly point by point. We've offered and continue to offer to discuss appropriate statutory consumer protections, including regulation by the Department of Commerce. We would welcome that discussion and moving that ahead. So we support a stakeholder process. There's no reason for us to not take a breath and make sure that there's a lot of trust around the table with the stakeholders. Our concern with the legislation is that there is no kind of blink-on date, that really we're suspending a policy indefinitely. And for industry folks like my company and others who really have to invest millions of dollars into a state before becoming operational, that regulatory uncertainty really creates a disincentive for investment in this state. So as the process moves ahead, we'd really appreciate it if the author and the other side would continue to have discussions about how to really frame that language so that we can ensure that PACE as a policy does not go by the wayside. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Padilla. Members, any questions? Otherwise, Mr. Johnson, you're up. Thank you, Ms. Padilla.
Thank you.
Oh, and Ms. Pugh, sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Very much appreciate the opportunity to be here and can keep my comments brief to get us out of here by 3:45, right, Mr. Chair?
I didn't say if that was a.m. or p.m. You're fine.
Okay.
We got time.
So, Mr. Chair, members, really do appreciate the effort that's gone into this bill. The League of Minnesota Cities has been a longtime supporter of the PACE program, both for residential and for commercial industrial. As you may be aware, commercial industrial property assessed clean energy program has been up and running successfully in Minnesota for quite a while now, and the federal mortgage agencies were the real reason that the residential stuff had held off. It's been in statute here, though, since 2006. So it's been a while in the making. And we do actually want to see this program be successful because cities are under a tremendous amount of pressure from our residents to try and help them find ways to do energy efficiency and renewable energy projects on their properties, whether it's a business or a home. And we have very few tools to do that. This is one that a community could choose to become part of a network, pass an ordinance that enters them into it, and move forward. And we are doing that in many communities now on the commercial industrial PACE programs. As far as House File 1377, our concerns really are focused on the language in lines 3.1 to 3.5, which is the suspension of the statute related to residential PACE. This is something that we think is overstated in this bill. I think there could be a blink on date by which the statute goes into effect if the legislature has not acted. The way it's drafted right now, unless the legislature acts exactly on the recommendations of this stakeholder group, it never blinks back on. And we just don't think that that's appropriate. One, it's limiting what the legislature can consider, and two, it's without adding separate language with notwithstanding and all those kinds of things. And secondly, this isn't a really difficult thing. We have consumer protections on many, many types of things already. I think it's just a matter of deciding which form and where in the process that happens. When a PACE program is set up, there is a third party that runs the program. In the case of commercial industrial PACE, it's the St. Paul Port Authority. And they are the ones that would administer it and know what the qualifications are for someone to be in the program in that. And it would be a similar setup with some entity under a residential program. So I don't think it's going to be something that takes years and years of time. I think it's something we could do in a reasonable period of time. And I would hope we could put a blink on date that makes it clear the intent is not to permanently end the program, but to take a time out while we make sure we've got the right protections in place, because cities would agree that that's a wise thing to do. We do want to make sure that people do have the protections before we move into a program and before a city would want to pass ordinances entering into one. That's all I have for you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Pugh.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Emily Pugh with the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC and the National Association of Counties support PACE as a voluntary financing option for property owners to make necessary improvements to their homes. PACE helps accelerate private investments in a variety of local economic development projects, improves local housing stock, and creates local jobs. Communities across Minnesota have been asking for residential PACE since the policy was passed in 2010. We believe in the stakeholder process, but we want to ensure that the policy is protected. The bill in its current form does not do enough to ensure that residential PACE will be available to Minnesota communities once consumer protections are adopted. So we encourage the committee to ask the parties to continue to work towards a compromise. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Buell. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to the cities and the counties. Does this PACE lien take precedence to your position?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it would be a standard special assessment. So it would, as far as I'm aware, it would be equal in standing under current law. I don't know that it's
429.
Mr. Chairman, what's 429?
I'm guessing part of the parable again. Representative O'Driscoll.
I'll leave that and abandon that for another day, Mr. Chair. Minnesota Statute 429 deals with property assessments from towns and cities on local or properties within their jurisdiction.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, as I've listened to this bill, Chair O'Driscoll, I think, has a pretty good bill here. And anytime you have the distinguished gentlemen such as Mr. Elwood and the bankers and others agreeing, I really don't want to get in the way of that. And, of course, the chairman of the GovOps Committee, too. But there are some problems here, and I think this bill really addresses them, but I still think this is probably a work in progress. Would that be correct, Chair O'Driscoll?
Representative O'Driscoll.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, what happens in a townhome situation when you have an association that has to get fees to continue operation, otherwise that gets passed on to all the townhome residents? How does that work with current law that we have right now? Can you help me out on that at all?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. Under Minnesota's Common Interest Community Act, the association decides how they want to levy special assessments that would come from a municipality in this case. So if the association said it would go to each of the individual property owners because they have a separate legal description, it could be done that way, or it could be assessed against the entire association. So you'd have to go back and look at your bylaws and your declaration to see how those things would end up being addressed.
Representative Anderson.
So you're saying that this would be then assessed, so if somebody goes into foreclosure, the rest of us that are in the Townhome Association would have to pay for that assessment?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I'm going to only leave my comments at what I did because that's how Minnesota's common interest community law works. Each association would have to address that themselves as to how they want to do it. The potential could exist that there could be others that could be affected by it, again, because it's by association resolution and they let the community know. Now, if one property owner themselves came in and asked for that, my hunch is that the association would have a provision that would allow that particular townhome or that particular unit to have that assessment. But again, those are issues that are usually addressed for special assessments, either privately or publicly, by resolution, and the community lets the private community lets the city know how they want to deal with those kinds of things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. With that, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Ms. Bew. Mr. John Kearney. Mr. Kearney, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Kearney. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, MNSEIA. MNSEIA has about 105 active members in our association right now, which includes everybody from small contractors to large solar implementers such as Mortenson and Blattner. In 2013, Minnesota was about a $50 million solar industry, and today, 3 years later, we're a billion-dollar industry, and thanks in part to this legislature. During that 3 years, we went from 13 megawatts of solar to 350 today, which is the equivalent energy for about 56,000 Minnesota homes. And the industry now employs 2,800 people in very good jobs. And also about 90% of the solar installed in Minnesota has been done by MNSEIA member companies. Regarding House File 1377, MNSEIA supports and will participate in the stakeholder process that is outlined in House File 1377. We have one concern about what is missing in this legislation, and we hope that that can be remedied, and that is that we want to have a date when the program clicks back on, and we would suggest that that date be sometime in May of 2018 before the end of the 2018 session. Our thinking there is that since House File 1377 mandates a consumer protection process, then we feel that since the consumer protection process will be in place, then there should be no reason why we wouldn't have a click-on date for the program. And also, other people testified, without a click-on date for the program, it's hard for people who invest in the program to plan ahead and take advantage of what the program has to offer for residential solar customers in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kearney. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody coming down. Representative O'Driscoll, we'll give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, members and testifiers, thank you. I will not end with the wolf, the sheep, and the shepherd, because it didn't start out well, according to the chair, but what I will do is I will say this, that when you start getting into Minnesota's 429 special assessment law, it really affects a lot of other lien holders on the property, and the consumer may not be fully informed about what that means and how that could affect their property and the sale of that property in the future. The other thing that I'm very concerned about and why I support the efforts and the spirit of this bill is that we don't always have up markets. We have down markets, and this could only complicate and become the next, if we don't handle it correctly and address the issues today, it could become the next housing crisis when we're trying to do lots of good things on this. So, Mr. Chair, members, I will just end with this. As we oftentimes know in the bill that was before me, oftentimes people will bring their laundry to the legislature and ask the legislature to do the laundry, but nobody likes the outcome of when the legislature does their laundry. So I'm hoping that this will allow us the ability to be able to bring stakeholders to the table and come to an equitable solution. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I want to thank my co-authors, Representative Hillstrom from the committee and Representative Barr as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative O'Driscoll, nice job. And I'd like to thank everybody that testified for and against the bill. Nice discussion, good questions. With that, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 1377, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll and members.
Chair Hoppe moves House File 739 to the Government Operations Committee. There is a D3 amendment. Mr. Chairman, is that your amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I would move the DE3 amendment.
Chair Hoppe moves the H0739 DE3 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all favors say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 739 as amended before us. Two-year bill, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, as has kind of been the theme today, this is a bill that is still a work in progress. We're going to get it out of here today and try to continue working on it before its next committee stop. There's been a lot of discussion on this bill. Most of the members, probably all of the members on the committee, have received letters from cities and from other interested parties. And what I keep telling everybody is it is still a work in progress. And with that, Mr. Chair, in the interest of brevity, I will turn it over to the expert testifiers.
Okay, thank you. I have several folks on the list here. I've got Beth and Andy, John, and Tony, and Amanda, Scott, and a Laura, and a Shelley, and a Chris. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of the bill that I did not mention?
Mr. Chair, Paul Wirtz with AT&T.
Okay, so we'll hear from you, and then is there anyone else that I did not read on the list that has concerns thereof? And did the department want to testify on the bill? Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cooley. I'm the Director of State Legislative Affairs at CTIA. I am here today. We are the Trade Association for the Wireless Communication Services Industry, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 739. This has to deal with the deployment of small cell facilities. The people of Minnesota today continue to demand at increasing levels access to wireless products and services. This is in fact demonstrated by the actual fact that there are more wireless devices in Minnesota than there are Minnesotans. These demands from the wireless industry's customers, who are your constituents as well, require that wireless networks be updated today and ready for the next generation of wireless networks. House File 739 is a needed mechanism to solve today's problem and help to realize the future. I won't get into the nitty-gritty of the bill. As the chairman referenced, this is constantly changing in motion, but I would just say that House File 739 removes barriers to efficient deployment of small cells by streamlining processes and imposing reasonable fees. So while we need these small cells deployed today to accommodate your constituents, our customers' demands, small cells will be an important building block for the next generation of wireless networks called 5G or fifth generation. 5G will connect 100 times more devices and be up to 10 times faster. You've probably heard IoT or Internet of Things. This will truly introduce the IoT into our country. This exciting time will also bring about great job and economic growth. In fact, Accenture recently published a study noting that 5G wireless networks could create as many as 3 million jobs and boost the U.S. GDP by nearly $500 billion over the next 7 years. In fact, we have some Minnesota-specific data in a handout of the top 25 cities by population. And so this is not just a pie-in-the-sky ideal. We have run, Accenture has run specific cities based on population. In fact, here in St. Paul, 5G benefits are estimated to create over 2,700 jobs and over $450 million in estimated GDP growth. Furthermore, a community like Oakdale, for example, would see the creation of over 260 jobs and $43 million in estimated GDP growth. So in the interest of yielding my time to further experts on the bill itself, I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you today. We are very excited for the jobs and economic development opportunities that 5G will bring across the country. It's important to note, though, that this doesn't happen without the proper wireless infrastructure in place. Capital tends to flow towards the path that provides regulatory certainty, and House File 739 is such a mechanism. We strongly urge your support, and I thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Members, we will hear from the three testifiers, and we'll open up for questions from members. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. I will introduce my colleague, Mr. Andy Emerson, with the law firm of Porter Wright. He represents our interests on a number of municipal issues throughout the country, including small cell legislation in many states. Mr. Chair, a couple of weeks ago when we did kind of the Telecom 101 hearing from the various industry members, I outlined AT&T's plan for getting to 5G wireless, which included our continued testing of millimeter wave technology, where we're conducting that trial in Minneapolis right now to deliver gigabit speeds to multi-dwelling units, a promise of Project AirGig, which is a 200 patent related service for broadband along power lines using wireless, and other wireless deployments, including active trials where we are conducting 5G tests right now, even before the international speed standards have been set. All of this is a critical part of the next generation of 5G wireless. Small cell deployment, these antennas are a key component of that infrastructure. It truly is the 21st century infrastructure. I know when I speak on behalf of just AT&T, but the other wireless carriers as well, you know, this is going to be kind of the game changer for all of us, for our customers, for your constituents. I know that for AT&T's perspective, because in the last 10 years, our network capacity, the data capacity, which is the demand for more and more services on that network, has gone up 250,000% in 10 years. Customers are already telling us they need better service, they want more service, they want better quality, and these small cells are going to help in the densification of that network, getting them closer to that better coverage. What we're experiencing, though, is kind of a missed opportunity and kind of a checkered roadblock, if you will, of how to get to the cities and get to that investment. I would cite a couple specifically here in Minnesota. In Bloomington, for example, in discussions with the city of Bloomington, we're seeing rates or rental rates for a small antenna being quoted at $6,000. These are some of the highest rates we're seeing in the country. In the city of St. Paul, and many of you may have seen this, and we can certainly provide it to you, there was an article about the deployment of small cells in St. Paul with the question that, you know, the anatomy of a small cell deal. Now, we don't talk within the industry about various rates, but the reporter did this. So Sprint and Verizon, a couple of years ago, executed deals for about $600 a pole, $700 a pole, and now the city of St. Paul aligned itself with a New York firm, Bench Strength Partners, that is now was then quoting T-Mobile at $7,000 to $8,000 per pole. I guess we got off a little lucky because they're quoting us at about $3,800 a pole. I know T-Mobile pushed back very hard with the city on those rates. We were told, you really can't talk to us, and that's the city. You need to talk to our firm in New York. So we also know that Bench Strength Partners is representing the interest of St. Paul and the city of Duluth. We haven't even started talking to Duluth yet. We probably have to turn right and go to New York to have that discussion. So you can imagine our frustration when we're seeing rates that were quoted that, and we're getting, you know, responses back from New York firms by email, if you will, where we know this is for the long-term improvement and enhancement of these cities. My company spent $40 million for their most recent Super Bowl. That's probably $1 million for every touchdown point that Tom Brady threw in the second half, roughly. But nevertheless, these investments just don't go in for an event. They're there for the long-term benefit of the city. So those are some problems that we're seeing, and that's really why this bill is so necessary, to kind of create some parameters, to create some investment certain, so that the carriers can begin the dialogue with the cities on how to get to get that technology into the cities, obviously with some local parameters of control. And my colleague Danny Emerson can speak specifically to the changes we've made with the amendment that was brought forth. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Yeah, let's go to Mr. Emerson, then we'll go to questions from members. Mr. Emerson. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andy Emerson. I'm an attorney with Porter, Wright, Morrison, Arthur in Columbus, Ohio. As Paul mentioned, I represent AT&T around the United States on small cell deployment. And in particular, I was engaged here to come in and collaborate and work with the cities and the cable industry and the Muni Electrics to try to negotiate a bill, as I've done in other jurisdictions. So the whole goal here was to try to, you know, find some middle ground. And I've been working on that over the last month. And what I'd like to do today is take you through step by step some of the puts and takes and some of the changes that have been made up to this point. You've got a handout in the packet that goes through some of the changes, and my goal here is just to cover some of those, and please ask any questions that you have. So the first one in particular, the League of Minnesota Cities expressed some concern about the original bill in terms of the definition of right-of-way, and that it was too expansive. And in particular, perhaps as it was written, it could include a municipal building. That was never the intent, so we deleted that section of the draft bill. The league also had some valid concerns about conditioning consent. And in particular, could they have the ability to apply generally applicable health, safety, and welfare regulation when approving a co-location permit for a small cell? So we added that to the bill. We also added language at their request for reasonable accommodations for decorative utility poles. That was a concern that came up in several Minnesota cities, as well as signs, decorative signs. So we added language along those lines to the bill. There was also a concern raised about restocking if there was new wireless support structures built in public right-of-way. So we added that to the bill also. The Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association requested some clarity on, in particular, generally applicable health, safety, and welfare in the National Electric Safety Code. So we added some specific language in line 8.12 here to be real clear about their ability in reviewing a permit to approve it or deny it based on a safety code violation or, you know, a concern about structural integrity. So that was added to the bill. There was also a clear concern about the height of these poles raised by the cities, so we added a 50-foot cap to any new structure to the bill. There was a concern raised by the cities to clarify that that the wireless support structures and the small wireless facilities would only be placed in public right-of-way. So we added language specific to that to make clear that this would not be any private easement areas. This was only going to be in public right-of-way. There was concern about the parameters about who could seek a co-location permit. In particular, you know, could someone just, you know, a speculator come and take space on a pole? So we made it clear that it had to be someone who was a provider of wireless service holding an FCC license in particular would be someone that could seek a co-location permit under this. Both the League of Minnesota Cities and the Minnesota Cable and Communications Association expressed concern about inclusion of initial engineering and make-ready costs for attachments rolling into a right-of-way permit fee And so we took that out of the section of the existing municipal code, Minnesota code, that dealt with the right-of-way fee and made an explicit section, subdivision 6, on fees, making it clear that the cost causer would pay these fees. This was something that they were concerned about, and we addressed it by putting specific language in the bill. They also had a concern about the breadth of the definition of a utility pole as it was originally written. And so we revised that definition so it's clear that it's only electric and telecom poles that qualify as utility poles, not just any other structure. So that was dealt with. There was a concern raised in the definition of small wireless facilities in terms of what equipment was excluded from the definition, the volumetric calculation for equipment. And so we took out ground-based enclosures at their request. And I promise I'm almost done. But I'm trying to stress here how much change that the bill has happened through these discussions. We removed a section of 15.99 from the bill that dealt with timelines. We took that out at their request. There was reference to an FCC rate formula in the bill that the League of Minnesota Cities wanted to be removed. We removed that to make that clear. There was a concern raised by the cable industry that they wanted to make sure there was equal treatment under the bill. And so to do that, we added to the definition of a telecom right-of-way user that a cable company, if it's going to deploy similar equipment, could go into the same process of a co-location permit under the bill. We also added a new definition of wireless service to specifically address their deployment of wireless, which is unlicensed spectrum Wi-Fi products. So we added that into the definition to make clear that they could take advantage of the exact same provisions. Lastly, we had a discussion with the investor-owned utilities. They had a concern about how this would affect their existing pole attachment agreements with attachers, and we made clear that nothing in this bill would affect that. Someone would still need to go get a pole attachment agreement in order to go on investor-owned utility poles. They'd still need to pull the same encroachment permit from the local entity to actually place something on a pole. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the end.
Okay, questions, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is both for the author and for testifiers from AT&T. I tend to hear about consumer protections, and I don't see any in the bill. So if you're the author, if you're asking for the state to weigh in and put their finger on the scale for this technology and to go over the heads of our communities to say, you're going to do this, and we're going to mandate how that's going to be done, what consumer protections are you going to put in place? And the reason I ask in particular about AT&T is because I pulled up the FTC reports, and there was an $88 million refund to customers from AT&T because they were improperly charging customers $99.99 per month for premium texting without their consent, and $105 million for cramming settlement that was going on. And so you're asking us to give the industry the ability to do this, and I want to make sure it's not just on a trust us.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom and members, it's a work in progress. We are going to have a bill at the end of the day that will have consumer protections in it, and it's not something that we're foisting upon the cities. As I said, we're continuing to work on this. I have three cities that I represent. Two of them dislike the bill and one hates it. We've got to make it so that I can go home tonight. We're going to get to that point where we can get this to the point where the cities don't, I mean, everybody's going to want this technology to make phones work. It's a question of how the cities get compensated for the rental and how we decide how these things go. And I think we all agree that we need to be looking at consumer protections.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also add that because we're changing definitions and allowing cable companies to do the same things, and, you know, we have some protections for landlines in Minnesota and requirements that people, you know, have services available to them. And I want to make certain that this isn't just kind of the end around all of it to undo all of those consumer protections.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, it's not an end around, and I have a feeling we're going to hear a little bit more about that later today.
I think you are.
Representative Hillstrom? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is to legal counsel. I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Mr. Emerson.
Anderson?
Emerson.
Emerson. Has the contract that AIDS spelled out maintenance responsibilities, for example, if the pole is faltering, if a car hits the pole, who's responsible for it? Construction occurs in the area where the pole needs to be removed, who pays for that? Has that aspect been addressed directly thus far?
Mr. Emerson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be in the permit. So in the co-location permit, when it's issued, would have the relevant terms and conditions consistent with your code. So if you have, you know, an indemnity provision or something, that would be in that permit.
Representative Johnson?
So has it been addressed to the satisfaction of League of Minnesota Cities, I guess? I wasn't sure. I didn't quite understand your answer, but whether they're okay with it, I guess, is what makes the difference.
Mr. Emerson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they did not bring that specific issue up. That's the answer, is it would be in the actual co-location permit, the terms and conditions. There's a provision in the bill that specifically states that. It doesn't get into all the details, but it would be covered in the co-location permit.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how about aesthetics? I've heard from several cities that they were concerned about the type of materials used, placement, that sort of thing, with respect to even less so than the right-of-way issue, how the material looks like, where it was placed, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Has that been addressed?
Mr. Emerson, will we be using porcelain?
Chair, Representative, no, porcelain probably will not be used for the deployment, but that concern was raised by the league, and it was addressed. We added a provision where they could condition consent. In particular, it was raised with respect to decorative poles and signs in historic districts. They would absolutely have the ability to speak to aesthetics and condition consent on aesthetics.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just briefly on fifth generation, I know that comes up a lot, and I know that's, I mean, it's something I think that's more a marketing term at this point than a reality. It's going to be out there for a while, the International Union of Scientists or whatever that set the standards. That's still, I think they're talking 2020 before that gets to that point. So I guess just that is what it is. One concern I have about the fifth generation, because once we do get there, I think this is especially true for the rural area. I think it's going to, I mean, what you're going to see, I think, is the big companies, again, investing in the city, which I'm all for because I live in the city, but I think you're going to see a further continuation of the digital divide in the rural area. And if you're a rural person, I guess I'd be concerned about the extent to which you're going to be able to get a piece of the pie as far as this fifth generation goes, because it's oriented towards a network of very closely sited cells, and practically speaking, that's not going to work very effectively in rural Minnesota. So just a word to the wise, as they talk about these things, there are also some practical effects, I think, that affect the ability in outstate Minnesota to get some of the same investments and benefits that we will enjoy sooner or later in the cities.
Mr. Wirtz, very briefly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, absolutely. If you look at where we've invested in other carriers, particularly in Minnesota, I think I pointed out 2 weeks ago, more than 272 communities last year in Minnesota received some type of network upgrade. We spend more than $100 million in Minnesota. I mean, we would argue wireless is broadband. I have a policy as a member of the Governor's Broadband Task Force. I have a policy disagreement with how we fund that because we're not taking advantage of wireless projects and wireless providers that could be providing fixed wireless internet like we're doing over in Wisconsin under the federal government with Connect America funds. Obviously, capital is going to flow to the path of least resistance, and these dollars are going to be up for grabs. But that technology is not just going to be metro-centric. It does have rural prospects. And I think particularly for us is that Project AirGig with more than 200 patents that have been associated. We're actively testing that right now.
Representative Johnson?
Well, I just reiterate that fifth generation is going to come sooner or later. And when it does come, I think the rural area is going to be in a difficult spot as far as getting the same benefits. So It's something I think you need to pay very close attention to.
Okay, let's go to Mr. John Dukic. I don't see any more questions for these folks. Are there any? Okay, let's go to Mr. Dukic for a very brief presentation. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. MHTA is a trade association that represents 300 science technology companies throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'll keep my comments brief, as the chair mentioned, but just wanted to draw your attention to a letter from MHTA in support of House File 739. As we've heard, the world is becoming increasingly wireless, and as a result, we need the technological infrastructure to support it. Cisco, for example, projects that global mobile data traffic will increase nearly eightfold between 2015 and 2020, and that by 2020, smart devices will account for three-fifths of all devices connected to mobile networks. And as the world begins to transition to a fifth generation of wireless networks that can accommodate large volumes of data, Minnesota should have in place the supporting technological infrastructure if the state hopes to take advantage of the benefits of these smart devices. Small cell technology will help increase network capacity while enabling the future of driverless and connected vehicles, the Internet of Things, and new mobile applications. And with this in mind, we encourage your support for House File 739. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier? Thank you very much, sir. Next, we have a Mr. Tony Mendoza and Amanda Duer. Okay, let's bring Mr. Scott Hain down, too. Or on deck. Let's go first with Mr. Mendoza, and then we'll go with Ms. Duer and Mr. Hain. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Tony Mendoza. I'm outside counsel for the Minnesota Cable Communications Association.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, committee members, a primary argument the wireless industry makes in support of its regulatory streamlining initiative is the need for non-discriminatory and competitively neutral access to public rights of way. The Cable Association shares that goal. However, without corrective changes to the language, House File 739 potentially creates a discriminatory regulatory environment favoring wireless competitors over others with respect to right-of-way access. Cable and telephone providers must obtain a franchise and pay millions of dollars each year in franchise fees in order to provide video services. But this bill would create a special exception from all of that for the wireless industry. That's not a level playing field in our view. Even with respect to broadband services, this bill tilts the playing field in favor of wireless at the expense of everyone else. For example, certain types of high-density Wi-Fi equipment, which many MCCA members are in the midst of deploying right now in Minnesota, would not enjoy the same streamlined right-of-way permitting process that would be granted to wireless companies under this bill. Fiber optic deployments would also not receive the same streamlined treatment. If there are going to be changes to the Minnesota right-of-way statute, MCCA believes those changes should be comprehensive, fair, and equitable to all parties. MCCA has been working with the wireless industry and with the author of the bill, Representative Hoppe, to resolve our differences with the bill, and we will continue to work in good faith to do so. However, until we are able to reach that consensus, MCCA remains opposed to House File 739. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I've got a question. I should know you. What did you do in a previous life? Like, didn't you do something before?
Well, I used to be a professional musician. I don't know if you ever saw me on stage, but I was also a deputy telecommunications commissioner with the Commerce Department.
There you go. Awesome.
A few years, so.
Okay, questions for Mr. Mendoza and where he's performing Saturday night.
With Ron Elwood. No.
With Ron Elwood. I'm coming to that one.
We're going to work these things out.
I'll be at that one. Okay. Questions? Okay, let's go then to Ms. Laura Ziegler. Thank you, Ms. Mendoza. League of Minnesota Cities and Ms. Shelley Hansen and Mr. Chris Bird. Do we have enough seating for those three?
Mr. Chair.
Chairman.
While the league is coming down, I think we should, as a committee, we should acknowledge Mr. Grunhofer, who would be here with the League of Cities and unfortunately recently passed away. He worked on this issue and you know, I didn't know him well, but I liked him and respected him, and I think we should take a moment to just acknowledge his passing.
Okay, let's pause for a moment of silence, members and audience. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ziegler. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for that moment of silence just now. We remain committed to this dialogue as well, especially in the wake of and continuing Tom's legacy of thoughtful consideration to public policy. In talking with Representative Hoppe, it's very true that it's extremely difficult for legislation to keep up with emerging technology, and so we're seeing that with this type of legislation. With this particular issue, it's important to note that nothing in current law currently prohibits these deployments from happening. Chapter 237, which this bill amends, has worked really well for over 20 years. And what I mean when I say it's worked really well is very limited challenges, and they've been able to work out agreements within current statute. Certainly, cities understand that their residents are going to want this technology, and so we are supportive of the rollout of any advanced communication services. And this is why we see these agreements happening currently in urban developments in Minnesota. And as I said, we are committed to continuing these conversations with the stakeholders. The League has met several times with AT&T and the wireless providers. We convened a large stakeholder group just a couple weeks ago. While the dialogue was constructive, the delete all language that you have before you today has not addressed our concerns, and therefore we remain opposed to House File 739, as it really takes away that core function, and when I say core function, I mean absolute core function of cities that the state has long recognized, which is to manage and control the public right-of-way. And not only does it take away the ability of local governments to say where these facilities can locate, it does so in a way that sets a precedent for for-profit companies to construct their capital at the expense of the taxpayer. So statewide uniformity in this case does mean taking away that local choice of city planners, engineers, council staff to provide this core function of the communities we live in, managing a tremendous public asset through the public rights of way to deliver services. As you all know, public right-of-way provides for all the vital public infrastructure in our state, sewer, water, the streets. And so cities have spent a lot of have spent taxpayer dollars to design and plan, and the bill really upends that work. There are often times that the public right-of-way can provide efficiencies in the delivery of important private infrastructure. However, even if this technology meets that threshold, there must be careful oversight and management to ensure that the public right-of-way is managed for the public. And the bill does not provide for adequate management and oversight and would have a significant impact, as it mentions, on the city's zoning ability. Even though it appears that a local government unit could deny a permit by a wireless provider in certain instances, the language as drafted is not clear. It's very ambiguous and would open up cities to lengthy and costly appeals and serious liability. So there, I've kind of outlined our, you know, philosophical opposition to the bill, but there's also some very practical considerations that the bill doesn't address. And there are multiple wireless carriers, unlike other regulated utilities where there might just be one provider. And so we've been told that 5G wireless could result in nine times more wireless antennas for every city. So, for example, if a city has 10 wireless antennas for each of the four main providers, each provider would need 90 new antennas. So this would equal 360 new antenna structures. And there's no recourse for a city if they were to receive that number of applications for all these sites within the 60-day shot clock requirement in this bill. It's fair to say that most cities would not be able to conduct a proper engineering review and other related assessments in this time frame, especially if there were a sea of applications by multiple providers. And we'll have my city engineer, as well as several others, talk to structural integrity, et cetera. There are also more costs associated with than just putting this infrastructure on the pole.
besides just permit applications and cost recovery. There's a lot of planning review that has to go into it. It's also not clear if cities can charge the companies for that initial review planning under the definition of management costs. It doesn't appear so in how we've read it. There's also provision that excludes a third-party fee from management costs, and that's very objectionable to us. If a private entity wants to go on publicly owned facilities, the city needs to verify that no harm is going to be done, and the local taxpayer should not bear that cost. As you know, cities have limited budget, limited staff time to address these applications, and oftentimes cities will, as you probably know, will contract out with engineers, and so they would essentially be that third-party contractor, and so we would not be able to incorporate that into our management costs that's allowed in the bill. I did want to address some of Mr. Emerson's points with the change items that were made. Like I said, we are committed to continuing the dialogue and throughout this process, but quite frankly, a lot of the issues that we raised at that meeting were just simply replaced later on in the bill. And some of the testifiers will go more in depth. For example, on the decorative signs, it still shows up in other parts of the bill that signage and kiosks and arches are permitted uses. 50-foot tall poles are still double in size of some decorative poles. And I know our Utilities Association will talk more about that. The make-ready costs that were talked about were taken out, but then it's replaced with the other language that I talked about with not being able to allow third-party contractor costs to be included in those management costs for recovery. And finally, another point, that one section was taken out that referenced 15.99, which is a federal reference, but then a 60-day shot clock was simply put back in and an automatic approval process if that 60-day clock is not met. And that's essentially the same thing. And so, like I said, we remain committed to the conversation, but we do need to see some of our core concerns with the bill addressed before moving forward. And with that, I think I will end my comments and just say in closing, there is nothing that's preventing these agreements from happening right now. Cities understand the desire by their residents to have this technology, and cities too, to help run the city. But they just need to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. And we also need to be able to assess properly whether the site is downtown Minneapolis or it's in Alexandria or it's in War Road. There's going to be some market-based rates that are going to be differentiated based on where these site locations are. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Shelley Hansen, the city engineer of Bloomington, to speak more about the technical aspects of the bill.
Okay. Ms. Ziegler, I'll put you down as a maybe. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Shelley Hansen, Bloomington City Engineer. I am also representing the Minnesota City Engineers Association of Minnesota today, which we have over 144 member cities.
Welcome to the committee.
Small cell throughout Minnesota is very important to our communities. It's important to our businesses, our schools, our residents. We want to be globally committed. All the cities throughout Minnesota, outstate, the metro, we're very committed to this. But this one-size-fits-all approach does not work for us, for all of Minnesota. It may work for parts. It doesn't work for all. And we want to continue this conversation. One of our big concerns is the definition of wireless support structure. It's very broad. It's still in the bill. It includes not only street lights but traffic signals, signs in the right-of-way. Those signs could be a stop sign. They could be a speed limit sign. They could be a no parking sign. It includes kiosks, which could be some of our decorative signs that the cities or the neighborhoods have put substantial amounts of money in into the right-of-way. And this needs to be addressed. One of the other definitions that we're very concerned about is small cell equipment. It's very broad. It's confusing. In any of these installations, there are already above-ground utilities, below-ground utilities, and existing utilities on the ground. And we need to get a better handle on what all their equipment is that's below ground, which includes electrical and fiber also, and different equipment besides just the equipment on the poles. We also need to be able to individually review these locations as they come in to make sure that they are safe and they're a practical location for all the users that are already in the right-of-way and the cell users also. The right-of-way is not just for the cellular providers, but it is for a multitude of utilities in the area. I'd like to just give some examples of management of the right-of-way that is complicated that you can maybe relate to in your day-to-day activity. One of them, and it has been mentioned, and a question was on downed poles. What happens if there's a downed pole? In the wintertime, we have crashes. We even have crashes in the summertime that will take a pole down. These, you know, that's usually one of our regular poles. Some of these cellular poles are much larger and have to be stronger, and they would be put in the right-of-way. And they are not only more expensive, but a lot of times they have to be special ordered. You know, our normal poles are in, some are in the warehouse. A special order pole could take anywhere from 3 to 4 months to get, to get the steel delivery. Our normal poles, we have them in the warehouse, they can be put back up in 3 to 4 days, especially if it's an area where a street light is important on our long, dark winter nights for safety and security purposes. So we are concerned about the poles. Also, another example would be if you have a the growing expense in the right-of-way of other utilities. We might have a water main break or a sanitary sewer break. You might start your dig with a backhoe, but with all the utilities underneath, if they're not properly placed and properly reviewed so they're in the right location, once you start digging with the backhoe, pretty soon you're digging with a shovel to make sure that you're not going to hit those things and take out someone's service. And that gets to be takes a long time. It gets to be more expensive for the public to repair it. And this is also a very concern of ours because it's very crowded in the right-of-way already. And we want everyone to be there. We just want to have the proper review time to make sure they're in the right place. Another thing that's problematic for us is installation on our traffic signals. As you know, there's often intersection accidents. And with those, there's often claims. And the claims come in, well, your traffic light malfunctioned, you know, for responsibility or liability during an accident. Cities are concerned that these claims might come back to, well, now you have small cell wireless hooked into your electricity on your traffic signals. They're hooked into your signals. How does the city respond to that? And who defends that case? And who pays for that if they come back at us for a signalized intersection? In short, we just don't think it's a good idea to have some of these small cell facilities on our traffic signals. We think some of the ground equipment might be problematic at intersections for Clearview Triangle visibility and safe sight lines. I'd like to talk a little bit about property damage, complications, and experiences to date. If a pole goes down, say in an adjacent property, adjacent parking lot, falls down from the street right away into the parking lot, and the pole misses the car, but the small cell equipment that's over above on the top of it hits the car. And who pays for that? Who's responsible? I don't think that that is all addressed at this time yet, and we need more conversation on that. Also, as I said earlier, the small cell operation requires electricity, and it requires fiber connection. Cities are then burdened with supplying small cell systems with power. And with that, you might also have non-city maintenance staff, could be cell carrier staff, that are going to possibly open our service cabinets, signal, street lighting bases to troubleshoot maintenance problems. And how do we deal with that? There are risks to the public, as it could be as a result of this. Our staff, there could be staff in there who aren't familiar with our electrical systems, and they could make a mistake and it could have an impact on the public. And these need to be carefully permitted so that we can make sure that that doesn't happen. I would like to give some examples of city experiences to date, and these include multiple permits that are submitted at the same time.
Ms. Hansen, how much more testimony do you have?
Okay, I'll wrap up.
It's extremely riveting, but we've got quite a few people to testify yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Some of the problems we've had to date are too many permits in at a time to be able, it's unattainable to with the staff that's on hand to get these done in the amount of time. And I guess with that, I'll just wrap up in conclusion. the Minnesota cities want small cell. We want small cell in our communities. Our right-of-way is complicated. Sites need to be individually reviewed, and definitions in the bill need to be clarified. And the cities that we have, been, we feel we've been working in good faith, and we respectfully request that additional time be given to work with the cellular providers to come to an agreement on these multiple items. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. If you have other testimony you'd like to provide to the committee, you can get it to Mr. Reynolds, and he'll give it to the rest of the members. So
thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Byrd, a condensed version. We still have quite a bit to do here today.
Very well. I will do my best. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name
and
is
if, excuse me, if the other two could stick around, I haven't opened up for member questions yet, please. Mr. Byrd.
Yeah, my name is Chris Byrd, and I'm the Public Works Director and County Engineer for Benton County, and I'm here representing the County Engineers Association. So we represent all 87 counties, and we're as diverse as our great state here. So I just want to echo what Ms. Hansen said. We share the same position as the city, and we're opposed to some of the or many of the provisions in the bill and the amendment. One, the least of which is not the expanded definition of the right-of-way, and the fact that now our poles that are placed in our right-of-way for highway purposes, i.e. traffic signals and light poles, are now subject to being granting permits for putting wireless structures on there. The rural discussion came up earlier, and a scenario came into my head that I'm afraid that the bill puts wireless carriers into a first-come, first-served situation. The language seems to direct counties into granting permits onto our light poles. But there's a practicality aspect that we've kind of touched on with structural capacity, but there gets to be a point where only so many devices would be able to fit on a pole. And as mentioned, there's multiple wireless carriers, even in the room today and out there. It puts, I think, counties in a difficult situation to have to grant the first person to apply for a permit access to an existing light pole, but not being able to grant the next person due to capacity or just space on our existing poles. Some of the language in the amendment bars us from asking for additional information that we didn't ask for a similar applicant. But that additional information could be included as additional structural investigation, whether if there's already devices on there, could your additional devices be placed on there in that aspect. So in the interest of brevity, I'll kind of conclude that that we have those same concerns. We do have county right-of-ways and county highways that travel through the cities, so they look very much like the city right-of-ways. But we also have the rural and suburban roadways, which have higher speeds. And that's a concern as well, is that when you start attaching these devices, not maybe the tower can structurally support it, but in a crash situation, that tower now behaves significantly different than if it didn't have that device on there. And our devices or our towers are engineered to perform in a certain way when a car impacts that. And we're now having to put devices on there that's going to change those characteristics. So that kind of concludes my comments.
Thank you. Questions for members for Ms. Ziegler, Hansen, or Mr. Byrd? Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hansen. I recently went through varying lines, telephone as well as cable and others, and it was orchestrated between four homeowners, and it was quite difficult. And there's not a lot of room left in some places. So could you tell me a little bit more about the county's, city's position, and Bloomington's in particular?
Ms. Hansen?
Well, we do feel there is room for the cellular providers to provide small cell service in Bloomington. We need just to have the appropriate time and jurisdiction to do those reviews to get the fiber in the right locations. So it takes time to review those with all the other utilities in place and the electrical service. But we do feel that in most of the areas that they'll need it, there will be room. We just need to have the proper engineering review and utility review for safety.
Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hoppe, I'm with you. I hope you guys continue to work together. My cities hate this bill right now, and I hope that you can come to a situation that benefits us all.
Well, Representative Rosenthal, I think they're warming up to it. Questions for members? Or maybe not. Ms. Ziegler?
No, Mr. Chair.
Oh, no, okay. I guess I read that one wrong. Questions for members for the three testifiers? Thank you so much, Ms. Ziegler. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. And thank you, Mr. Bird. Now we'll, the last two I have, Mr. Hain, Scott Hain, and Amanda Doerr. If you could please join us. And Amanda Doerr is with the Municipal Utility Association, and Mr. Scott Hain, General Manager of Worthington Public Utilities. Worthington, would that be like the Trojans?
You got it.
All right. And also, my committee administrator is from Worthington. I'd like to talk to you afterwards a bit. I've got a few questions.
We can do that.
Okay.
I've been there a long time.
Okay, thank you. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my name is Amanda Doerr. I'm the Government Relations Representative for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. And thank you for your indulgence for letting me go after the league. I was hoping to be Representative Hoppe's favorite testifier by not rehashing several of the points that they made.
You can still do it, Ms. Doerr.
No, I will not. We share many of the concerns that they highlighted, and we know you have a long agenda. But we want to express our appreciation, you know, that AT&T has been willing to sit down and talk with us and has attempted to address some of our concerns. However, we remain concerned about this bill, and we hope we can continue the productive dialogue that we've been having. There's language that remains in the bill pertaining to maximum heights and minimum separation distances that still presents safety concerns to our members. Additionally, allowing a single application for 35 small cell antennas is problematic, as other testifiers have said. Different structures have very different structural integrity and loading capacity, and we would need assurance that all or part of a application could be denied because of the structural integrity of a proposed site if it could not support a wireless antenna. Also allowing for the antenna's ancillary equipment to be up to 28 cubic feet is altogether too large. I mean, that's the size of a refrigerator. And that's very likely too large and too heavy to be hanging off a streetlight. It's important to note that many MMUA member cities have been approached by wireless providers and have developed mutually acceptable agreements for the co-location of small cell wireless antennas within their right-of-way. The cities and the municipal utilities have worked together to find locations that meet the provider's need as well as protect the public safety. And that's how the process should work and has worked. And when we're talking about installing antennas that emit radiation on energized structures and high voltage distribution lines, this local control is really in the best interest of public safety. So now I'd like to turn it over to Scott Hain, who is the general manager of Worthington Public Utilities, who is one of the cities that have come to agreement with the wireless provider.
Please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Scott Hain. I'm the general manager of Worthington Public Utilities, and I certainly am not going to belabor everything that you've already heard. I'm here to tell you that it can be done. Under the current regime, we have successfully negotiated small cell deployment in Worthington, and essentially using the same procedure and protocol that we use for all right-of-way applicants. It took some time. It's a new technology. We had to learn about it. There was a learning curve, but now that we've gotten there, if the current provider wants to expand or a new provider comes in, we've got the template, which really didn't exist prior to that. We've got an agreement. One thing I will belabor is the importance of the core function of a municipality to manage the right-of-way. It's a very limited space. Worthington is a bit unique. We're a 100% underground utility. We have been for over 30 years. We don't have traditional utility poles. The only structures we have are streetlights. Streetlights are not designed to accommodate a lot of extra loading, and that has already been addressed. I completely agree with the testimony provided by the wireless providers. I mean, the people want this technology. the cities want it for their citizens. But as I was listening to that, I'm thinking, you know, our citizens, your constituents, were also demanding electricity and telephone and cable TV, and all of those services have been accomplished with the right-of-way control taken care of at the local level. So it does work, and I think it's important that we continue down that path as opposed to providing exemptions from local control to, you know, singular industry segments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hain. Questions from Ms. Dewar or Mr. Hain from members? Okay, thank you very much. Would you like to wrap it up, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, I think that we had some pretty good testimony right here. People want this. It's coming. The cities want it. We just have to figure out how to do it so my cities don't hate me. And I think we're going to continue to work on it, and I think that we can get there. And we'll keep working with all the interested parties, and we're going to try to get something done that we can all go home and talk about.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of people, a lot of my cities called in today, and I was kind of busy. Didn't return the phone. Okay. So with that, Representative Hoppe renews his motion to send House File 739 as amended to the Government Operations Committee for the discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Item next, we have the last bill for today, House File 1665. Representative Crescia. So, Representative Crescia moves House File 1665. And it would be to the Jobs Committee members. There's an author's amendment. Representative Crescia moves the H1 665A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all fair say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. 2-year bill is amended. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this is a bill that is very similar to one that we passed off the House floor last year. And what this just simply does is it seeks to freeze the regulation where we are today on the VoIP technology. We do include some provisions in here for handling 911 service charges and not getting in the way of the PUC's jurisdiction over intrastate switch to access rates. And with that, I'll allow for testifiers and questions.
Okay. I think we will start with some testimony. Let's just go down the list here. Mr. Tony Mendoza. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair. Tony Mendoza on behalf of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you for the opportunity today to address Cable Association's strong support for House File 1665. This is important legislation for our state that will speed the deployment of a strong competitive option for voice communication services, particularly in Greater Minnesota, provide greatly needed regulatory certainty with respect to voice communication services, encourage greater broadband investment in Greater Minnesota, preserve existing landline phone services for all Minnesotans, strengthen 911, TAP, and TAM programs by requiring all voice over internet providers to pay into these funds and file 911 plans, and move to Minnesota into the 21st century by joining 33 other states that have modernized their telecommunications laws toward a national uniform policy. Our state law governing telecommunications services, Chapter 237, is based on laws that date back 100 years. Many of these laws date back to an era when there was one provider of telephone service and no comprehensive federal telecommunications regulatory scheme like we have today. It would be an understatement to say that today the telecommunications industry is vastly different, perhaps unrecognizable for someone that was alive in 1915. Internet technology has fundamentally changed the way we make telephone calls and the competitive landscape for voice communication services. Today, there are a myriad ways of communicating with one another: voice calls, texting, chat rooms, email, video conferencing, and social media. And the market for all of these services is extremely competitive. Many companies now provide phone service using the same technology the providers of email, texting, and other web applications use, IP technology. Voice signals are packetized into data, transported via broadband, and miraculously reassembled at the other end to allow you to talk in real time with the person you dialed. This technology has come to be known as Voice over Internet Protocol technology, or VoIP, and it runs like other applications over broadband networks. We refer to them today as applications or apps. Email, texting, video conferencing, social media, these applications are not regulated by states like common carrier utilities, which is why we have seen investment and competition for these types of services explode. But there has been uncertainty about apps like VoIP. In 2004, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission attempted to assert regulatory jurisdiction over Vonage, a VoIP provider, one of the first VoIP providers in the state of Minnesota. Vonage challenged the MPUC's assertion of state jurisdiction, and the Public Utilities Commission lost. The Federal District Court for Minnesota and the FCC preempted the MPUC's attempt to assert jurisdiction over Vonage's VoIP service. But 13 years later, the state is again attempting to assert jurisdiction over VoIP, this time arguing that certain kinds of VoIP providers are subject to state jurisdiction, while others are not. VoIP providers have again had to challenge the Commission's jurisdiction in federal court. There is no more justification for applying burdensome century-old telephone regulations to VoIP than there is for applying those laws and regulations to email, texting, data processing, or social media. And there is certainly no rationale for subjecting one type of VoIP provider to comprehensive state regulation, but not others. Can you imagine having to get the state's permission to offer a new mobile app like Snapchat, or to expand the service area of an app like Snapchat from the Twin Cities metropolitan area to, say, Little Falls? The bill protects consumers in multiple ways. House File 1665 explicitly now preserves carrier of last resort obligations that apply to traditional landline telephone companies. If grandma wants to keep her rotary dial phone, nothing in this bill will take that away from her. The FCC continues to have broad regulatory authority, as does the Minnesota Attorney General through general consumer protection laws and through the Communications Act of 1934 as it was updated in 1996. State consumer protection laws are explicitly preserved in this bill. VoIP provides the most cost-effective consumer protection of all, competitive choice. VoIP competes fiercely on price and service quality. VoIP also features rich new features such as unlimited national calling, mobile messaging, and unified messaging applications. According to the FCC, at the end of 2015, there were more than 920,000 VoIP subscriber lines in Minnesota receiving service from 147 VoIP providers. 449,000 of these lines were residential lines, 472,000 were business or governmental customers, and these numbers have likely increased since then. Where VoIP is available, the market is competitive. And for that reason, 33 states have adopted VoIP regulatory reform. Not one person in any of those states is losing access to their phone service. To the contrary, with the expansion of broadband to rural areas, more people will have access to more competitive options for phone service, not less. The number of complaints to Minnesota regulatory agencies about VoIP service is minute relative to the hundreds of millions of calls these customers place each year. In a 2015 study by the National Regulatory Research Institute, which is the research arm for the National Association of State Utility Regulators, showed that consumers have not lost landline service in states that have modernized their VoIP regulations, prices have not increased, and service quality has not suffered. House File 1665 strengthens the 911 program, the Telephone Low Income Assistance Program, and the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program. With respect to 911, House File 1665 makes clear that all VoIP providers must pay into the 911 fund and file annual 911 plans. That's not the case today. Today it is estimated that there are at least 95 VoIP providers in the state who are not doing so. With respect to TAP and TAM, House File 1665 will strengthen these programs by ensuring that more VoIP providers pay into these funds. VoIP is also key to broadband investment. VoIP is one of the key services provided over broadband connections, and regulatory certainty is an incredibly important factor to companies that are considering making new broadband investments in Minnesota. Today, we simply do not have that kind of regulatory certainty in Minnesota. Broadband companies can't be sure whether they will be hampered by regulatory delays and decisions over whether to enter the market, expand the market out of the metropolitan area. And there are other broadband investment chilling regulations, including burdensome regulatory reporting and tariff filing requirements, merger and acquisition approvals that can take months to complete, and the approval of promotional offerings. The prospect of utility-style regulation over VoIP hangs over the heads of broadband providers in Minnesota, freezing broadband investment decisions in the state. The Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 says this: it is the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the Internet and other interactive computer services unfettered by federal and state regulation. And the
Mr. Mendoza, how much more you got for us here?
2 seconds.
Okay, thank you.
The FCC has said this about VoIP regulation: we cannot permit more than 50 different jurisdictions to impose traditional common carrier economic regulations such as Minnesota's and still meet our responsibility to realize Congress's objective. The FCC wants a national uniform policy, and House File 1665 aligns Minnesota with that national uniform policy. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mendoza. Questions for members? Okay, thank you. Let's then go to Mr. John Dukic, Minnesota High Tech Association. Thank you, Mr. Mendoza.
Thank you.
Please state your name and who represents for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. Again, I'll keep my comments brief and just reference a letter in your packets supporting House File 1665. By providing a level of regulatory certainty with respect to VoIP, House File 1665 helps to send a strong signal that Minnesota embraces technology-friendly policies and encourages private investment to help extend our broadband infrastructure to all corners of the state. Modernizing the state's telecommunications regulatory framework, as 30 other states have done, will help accelerate investments in new communication technologies and expand access to broadband, helping make Minnesota more competitive. And with this in mind, we ask for your support for House File 1665. Thanks.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author, if I might.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
To the author, there's been discussion and testimony that this would make it consistent with the federal regulation. Has there been any tweets about this subject matter, and do we know if the current administration is going to leave this regulation to the states as many other areas we're starting to hear about?
Representative Creature.
Not to my knowledge.
Representative Hillstrom.
There'll be more questions later, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Where are we? Mr. Elwood. And Ms. George, if you want to come down at the same time. Mr. Elwood's been saying yes to a lot of things today. You might want to keep an eye on him.
May I bring the bankers up with him?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, thank you. Of course, it's always uncomfortable to be sitting here in opposition to any legislator's bill, but especially Representative Creature's bill, for he has always been so gracious to me, and so this is a bit uncomfortable. But nonetheless, I'm going to testify in opposition to this bill. I'm sure you've all had a chance to thoroughly review the tome that I sent you last night. But in case you haven't, I'm going to just summarize it briefly. First, we should be really clear as to what VoIP is and what VoIP is not. First of all, VoIP is a platform for landline service. It is just like you take I-35 or I-94 or University Avenue or Rice Street to get here to the Capitol, you can use copper, cable, fiber, or VoIP to deliver a phone call. And the distinction here is not between VoIP and landline. It is between VoIP, a landline service, and wireless service. Consumers cannot tell the difference when they make a phone call as to how that phone call is being delivered. It's the same phone they use. They pick it up, and they have no idea about how it's being delivered. VoIP is not the Internet. Second, we should be clear about what this bill does. It deregulates a local phone call. That's what this bill does. And attached to the analysis that I provided is more than 35 consumer protections and statute and rule that will go away if this bill becomes law. The testifier suggested that everything will remain in place, but I think that's somewhat disingenuous. It will remain in place, but it will be both ineffective and unenforceable. And states are experiencing service problems, 911 problems, and more outages in places where they've done this. Our fundamental disagreement on this bill is that we believe just because technology changes in the way you deliver a phone call, the phone call, the service that we're talking about here, we see no reason to dismantle the universal service protections and the other consumer protections that are still needed and have served Minnesota well for many years. Third, this is a legal and technical issue. This has been around before, and the last attempt was to preempt the PUC from ruling that the state had jurisdiction over VoIP. That horse is out of the barn, so now this bill is an attempt to overturn the PUC. That decision is currently in the hands of the Federal District Court in Minnesota. It will undoubtedly be appealed to the United States Court of Appeals, 8th Circuit, and it's not unlikely that it may wind up in the United States Supreme Court. And that is where it belongs. Moreover, the FCC or Congress may decide this question. I would submit that the Minnesota legislature should not preempt those decision makers, all of which are more legally and technically versed in this complex issue than this body is. And finally, we've heard a lot of promises about the desire for regulatory certainty and promises about how service will improve and all sorts of broadband deployment will occur. But I think it's ironic that the proponents want certainty, but they support their proposal only with speculative and unsupported promises. In other places that have gone down this road, those promises have failed to materialize. If this bill becomes law, the persons who will be most harmed are all the constituents who live in greater Minnesota, who are more expensive and less profitable to serve. They will be left with no choice or the choice of a cell phone that is still unreliable in many parts of the state. Though I've given it the old college try here, I suspect that neither the analysis I provided nor this testimony will alter the outcome of this hearing. But I do want to leave you with one story. Last year when I talked to a secondary supporter of this bill, and I want to make it absolutely clear, it is not Comcast, it is not AT&T, it is not the Cable Association, and it is not the MTA. So this is not coming from them. But I had a conversation and asked, why would we want to remove all the protections and guaranteed access to phone service to the phone network? And the answer was, there will always be collateral damage when we have an advancement in technology. And frankly, I don't see our clients as collateral damage, and I hope we can ultimately prevent the damage from occurring here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Johnson, did you? Mr. Elwood, I think we had a question for you.
Sorry.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mr. Elwood, brief question on the amendment as I try to understand it. Subdivision 5, where it deals with carrier of last resort. Now, having talked with the PUC.
Representative Johnson, what page are you on? Or is it the one page?
I'm just looking at the amendment.
Okay, gotcha.
Having spoken with the PUC, they've made it clear to me that we're transitioning to an all-IP managed network with all our telecommunication systems, and that, in fact, land telephone service currently, almost all of them have, to some extent, IP-enabled services within their system. So when I look at this amendment, it basically says to me that it's meaningless, that the carrier of last resort is no longer in play. Am I reading it correctly, or how do you read it, understand, or perhaps I'm increasing of a different interpretation, but that's how I read it. That, in fact,
I don't read it that way, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood, you want to answer that, and we'll let Representative Kreischer respond after that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, so the way I read this is that if you're providing service through copper or fiber or another mechanism other than VoIP, then the it doesn't affect the obligations of phone companies. But if everybody is transitioning to the voice over protocol, then that would be a meaningless protection. So currently, the bill that we passed last year, the CenturyLink bill, relaxed regulations for CenturyLink, putting them on the same par with all of the CLECs and everybody else, at the same time cementing into place the obligation to serve. So what this would simply do is say that if you're providing service through VoIP, you wouldn't be subject to any of those things. And as the whole industry transitions, then it would be, as you point out, ultimately a meaningless concession.
Representative Johnson, do you want to respond to that?
No, but that's where I read it. And I think that would be in effect now as it relates to this particular subdivision. One final question for Mr. Elwood, having to do with 911. I'm familiar enough with VoIP to know that doesn't provide precise geographical information when you're calling. How would that affect 911? I mean, it seems like we need some PUC oversight to ensure that that essential public safety issue has some oversight.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, there was a story in the on NPR in August about some real serious problems with 911 and VoIP. Several situations occurred, one of which a fire occurred, and there was a 911 call through VoIP, and it was in Chanhassen. It read Chan, and nobody knew where it was, and the house burned down. And so there is some technical problems. I can certainly provide the article for the committee. So apparently there is some problems, the interface with the 911 and the VoIP technology.
Mr. Elwood, I'd like to see that article. If you could, that'd be great. Representative Kreischer, did you want to respond to the first point? I apologize if I...
No. Okay. I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. George.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mary Jo George, and I'm the Associate State Director of Advocacy with AARP Minnesota. I think I'm the lamb here. If we look at the last testifiers, and we have the analogy. But we, from our perspective, we do appreciate the opportunity to testify. But on behalf of our members, we do have to respectfully oppose this bill because it does unnecessarily eliminate important consumer protections relating to an increasingly popular telecommunications service known as VoIP. As telecommunications networks migrate to the use of technologies based on internet protocol, consumers still need reliable service and need regulatory oversight of carriers' practices. As Mr. Elwood said, regardless of how the technology is delivered, telephone communication remains a basic necessity, allowing older Minnesotans to maintain social contact, preserve health and safety, and gain assistance in an emergency. It's not the same as being able to text or to email if you're in need of help. Unfortunately, this bill eliminates state regulatory oversight of VoIP, which we have now today, precisely at a time when consumers' demand for VoIP is increasing. In addition, it eliminates, as Mr. Elwood said, many of the critical consumer protections, such as protections against discriminatory pricing, service quality rules, so that you're to ensure that your phone is repaired in a timely manner, protections against having your phone shut off without notice, and also unwanted charges being placed on your bill without your knowledge. Today we think there are several arguments that the industry is making that we have to challenge. One is the notion that landlines are dead. I think, again, we've already heard VoIP technology is essentially a wireline that is an alternative to traditional copper landline service. But it's important, and it's an important way that consumers obtain telecommunication network. In fact, approximately 80% of people who are age 65 and older continue to subscribe to wireline service. So it's important that we maintain these regulatory framework that we have. The second issue I want to say is simply because other states have eliminated their authority over VoIP doesn't mean we have to either, nor does it mean it's in the good interest of public interest. In some instances, I think states relinquished their authority long before we even knew VoIP was going to be connected to the public switch network. And also, many states had the chance they deregulated before they understood the implications of the legislation. And so now we're seeing that many states are going back to investigate because contrary to what I think the industry said, we are seeing increases in prices, increases in customer complaints. And finally, I think there's no evidence that the state's oversight is impeding the industry's broadband investment. We think that companies are profitably offering VoIP as part of their marketing strategy, and we welcome new technology, but we don't think it's a false choice between investment in technology and this veiled threat that somehow we can't have consumer protections or that we are going to withhold investment. We think you should ignore and reject these arguments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. George. Mr. Zahn. Mr. Zahn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Curtis Zahn. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you for giving me the time today to provide some comments to you regarding House File 1665. Let me begin by stating that the Department supports the comments made today regarding the importance of consumer protections that are currently provided to Minnesota telephone customers. These are common sense protections that this legislature has determined that all Minnesotans who receive telephone service should have. Things like, as been mentioned, the right not to be charged for services that you did not explicitly ask for or authorize by either the telephone company or a third party. Being entitled to a refund if your service is out for 24 hours because you're not getting the service that you paid for. Requiring that deposits be reasonable. Requiring that notice be given before your service is disconnected and that it cannot be disconnected on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, a legal holiday, or any other time telephone companies' offices are not open to the public. Requiring notice before the cost of your services is increased. Prohibiting companies that provide telephone service from engaging in practices that discriminate. Requiring telephone companies to charge rural customers the same prices for the same services that it charges to metro customers in its service area. And providing a forum for disputes so that customers can have their complaints heard and resolved in a timely manner by a neutral decision maker at no cost to them. And these are just a few. As Ron pointed out, there you've been handed out a list of many other consumer protections. It's wonderful that the industry is beginning to implement more cost-effective ways to provide telephone service to Minnesotans. This saves the industry the cost of the massive amounts of equipment that was acquired by less efficient means of providing telephone service. Recently, I was given a tour of a central office in Bemidji where I saw that huge banks of telephone equipment and large cables could be replaced with a single column of equipment and much smaller cables. This not only reduces the number of employees required to maintain the equipment, but also the amount of energy required to power it. Those types of changes in technology possibly warrant opening the discussion about what types of requirements and protections are still needed to ensure a fair marketplace and protect Minnesotans. And in fact, that type of discussion is currently happening. The Department of Commerce is working with the industry to prepare a report to the Public Utilities Commission about the service quality rules, or what service quality rules should be changed to reflect the current technology. And these discussions are ongoing. Those technology changes, however, are not a good reason to simply get rid of all of the requirements and protections that this legislature has previously determined are in the public interest without any discussion about their merits or their costs or benefits. To think about this in a similar context, think about the automobile. Like the telephone, it's been around for a long time, but it still does essentially the same thing it does when it was created. It transports a person from A to B, just like a telephone transmits a person's voice from A to B. Like the telephone, the technology used to transport a person is becoming more efficient. Cars today are beginning to use electricity instead of combustion. However, just because the technology has changed, would it be reasonable to remove the requirement that electric cars have seat belts or airbags? Should electric cars not be subject to lemon laws? Should electric cars not be required to obey the same traffic laws that combustion cars are required to comply with? Because electric cars are doing essentially the same thing as cars have always done, is there a good reason to change the requirements and protections that are applicable to them? But more importantly, would it be prudent to throw out those protections and requirements without a discussion of whether or not that was in the public interest? Telephone service is no different, but that is what the bill before you today is doing. It is throwing out the protections that this legislature has determined are in the public's interest without any discussion about their merits, costs, or benefits, just because the technology is changing. If the service is the same, shouldn't the protections be the same? But this committee should consider an even more basic question, and that is this a discussion that even needs to take place at this time? As been discussed, there is a lawsuit currently pending in federal court that will decide whether the state has authority to regulate fixed VoIP telephone service. If it decides the state does not, then this legislation is completely irrelevant, and this committee has spent valuable time on something it didn't need to. If the federal court determines that the state does have authority, then that would be a reasonable time to consider what, if any, changes should be made based on the changes in technology. And we should make clear that what we're talking about today is not the Vonage case. Not all VoIP is the same. This is much more like, what we're talking about today is much more like traditional phone service than it is like email or Snapchat. This is not the internet. This is simply a way, a technology to transmit telephone service today. And one last thing to consider, and it's been discussed a little bit, is the effect this bill will have on the rates and availability of telephone service to Minnesotans in rural areas, where the cost of providing service is substantially higher than the metro area. Before the drastic changes made by this bill are passed, it'd be prudent to consider how much more rural customers will have to pay and whether service will even be available to them. Thank you for providing the time for us to discuss our comments with you.
Thank you, Mr. Zahn. I think we have a couple of questions. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last testifier touched on this a little bit. Why, but this is a question for the author. Why is this in the purview of the Minnesota legislature? Isn't this really more of a congressional issue or in the courts? It seems to me that that's where it should be with the FCC. Some of those groups that are national in focus as opposed to in our little sweet Minnesota legislature.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Slocum. As you may know, 34 states have already handled this. This is happening globally, and what's happening is if we don't get some certainty around these regulations, companies are just simply going to pull out or they're not going to come in. You can see that from a number of studies that European countries have moved to deregulation and VoIP, and what's happened is they're growing fastly in these telecommunications services. The United States continues to be stubborn about this and slow, and therefore that technology is not following. So what I'm advocating here is that we just hit the pause button on regulation if what we're doing today is working, let's stop that and let's be where we are and let's allow for new technologies to come in. So I absolutely think this is in the purview of the legislature to increase that type of investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But with states doing different things, we're going to end up with a patchwork. And you're going to end up with different consumer protections state by state. Mm-hmm. You're going to end up with different, well, there aren't any in this bill, consumer protections, really. Very few in this bill. And I just see a real patchwork, whereas if it was done federally, it wouldn't be. It would be more cohesive and less state by state for a service that everybody uses, you know?
Representative Slocum, I hope you're not suggesting that Representative Creature run for Congress. We need him here.
The district is he in.
Okay, you win. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, are we done with all the testifiers, or are there more?
That was the last one we have on the list. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody. Thank you, Mr. Zahn.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to, like, ask a bunch of questions as the testifiers went on, and I could have done that and kept us here all night, and I decided that I didn't want to do that, Mr. Chair, and I thought it was just easier for me to make a statement after all the testimony was done. Members, I have been pretty vocal on consumer protections, especially related to landlines, for a long time. We saw the bill last year that Representative Kreisha and Representative Johnson negotiated and worked out, and less than 9 months later, we're back attempting to undo those very same provisions. I didn't think we got a good deal last time, and I think this is an even worse deal. Members, we have an aging population, not only in Minnesota, but in this country. And I don't know about you, but many of the folks who are in the generation before me that are related to me are a little bit technology adverse. And so they like to have their landline, and they like to have their telephone, and sometimes even say, I don't know why they got rid of the dial, right? So our population is aging, and we need to have stable telecommunication. And that has been the Minnesota Telephone Service. And we have had consumer protections for and regulation for 100 years. Now, if you undo all of the regulation, which this bill does, and all the consumer protections, here's what happens. People who are poor get less quality service because they can't afford it. People who live in greater Minnesota or in places that are not on where there's a large population pay more because right now, no matter where you live, you have to get charged the same amount for the same service. So places like the Metro do subsidize places in greater Minnesota where there is less population. You get to a place now where they don't have to tell you before they shut off your service. And guess what? They don't even have to let you know really how long it's going to take them to fix it. So in some states, like California, they made companies civilly liable for any harm that's caused if a resident can't call 911. You can't call 911 because your phone service doesn't permit you to do that. The company is civilly liable for the harm. Now, we haven't gone down that path here in Minnesota, but, Mr. Chair, you kind of leave us with no other alternative. Residents of Minnesota expect they're going to pick up the phone and there's going to be a dial tone. They expect they're going to pick up the phone and they're going to be able to call 911, and 911 is going to be able to figure out where they are even if they can't say what their address is. Those are some of the basic things that Minnesota residents expect. And Representative Kreisha, I believe that all of those protections are undone in your bill. And I think it's wrong. And I'll be done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Johnson. Oh, did you have a question?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, on one hand, it's a simple issue, and in some respects it can get complicated or pushed in a complicated way, but basically it comes down to
you've got a person making a phone call here to a person making a phone call here on a managed system, as it has always been for the last 100 years. Now, whether it's the old analog, which we see in the landlines of the past, or transitioning out to this internet protocol, to the person using a phone, it doesn't make a bit of difference. It's still a phone call. They don't know if it's VoIP, if it's internet protocol, if it's a set of technical rules that establish packet switching or not, versus in some analog signal. They don't know that. What they do know is that they deserve the same consumer protections that they have always had. And to use this IP as a way to take away these protections that have been in place, as Representative Hillstrom said, for a century, just makes absolutely no sense. I mean, Representative Creasy, do you believe, for example, that you should be able to cut off someone in rural Minnesota their telephone service with no notice? Zero notice, just cut it off. Because that's what's in this bill. Do you think that's a good idea?
Representative Creasy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, can you point me to the line that says you can cut them off? Because I have an amendment that says, I will add an amendment that says you cannot physically go into somebody's house over the age of 55 without their express permission to cut them off. So what line would that be? And I'm happy to add that.
Well, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, where it states in subdivision one, I wasn't sure if I totally understood your amendment in terms of number six there, as far as enforced chapters 325C to 325G. But where it says regulation permitted 2.3 to 2.7, all those regulations entailed the consumer protections we're talking about, the consumer protections that Mr. Elwood gave that are in the back of the all those forms he provided, one of them which is being able to shut off with no notice. I was looking, for example, at a CenturyLink contract here that's currently in effect. I think it's in Alabama, and it says they have the right to terminate without notice, and that's part of the official contract that they sign. And this is an area where VoIP has been deregulated. Now, do you think that makes sense? Is that a good idea to just person goes on vacation, they come back, their phone's been shut off, no notice? To me, that's ridiculous.
Representative Creasy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're not in Alabama, first of all. And the second thing is, nothing in this bill undoes anything. There is no cramming or slamming that happens here. That happens on the analog systems. It does not apply to the VoIP.
Representative Johnson.
Well, I'm not sure if that's exactly true on the slamming and cramming. I don't know if there's anybody here from the PUC to address that, but I'm not sure that's accurate. I mean, no matter how you cut it, you're getting rid of all the consumer protections that have been in place for this long time for no good reason. And I just don't understand. Is there anywhere in this bill where it promises broadband investment? We hear about broadband investment, how this is going to increase broadband investment. There's nothing that prevents broadband investment now, as I understand it. I mean, where do you see broadband investment being increased as a result of this bill?
Representative Creasy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I've sponsored a couple pieces of legislation to that effect. But the other thing is, this bill just stops where we are with our regulation and gives certainty. We can read into this all we want, but if I pick up the phone today and I can make a phone call, if this bill passes, I'm going to be able to pick up a phone and make a phone call tomorrow. I think there are senior citizens in Europe that are experiencing the effects of quality VoIP service. I think there's senior citizens in the other 34 states that have had these regulatory certainty principles put in place. I have yet to see protesters of senior citizens saying we want our VoIP.
Representative Johnson.
I just point to regulation prohibited terms, quality of service, availability, classification. It's all in your bill, and all of that those issues become no longer available to all these citizens that had it. You know, you don't take enough credit for that, for the work we did on that bill last year. There was one piece of legislation that I think Mr. Mendoza noted, the National Regulatory Research Institute, that's the utility commission that governs all 50 states. They cited one piece of legislation in 2016 that dealt with any regulatory reform, and that was the bill that you and I had.
Mm-hmm.
So now to come in with a new bill that basically blasts all the consumer protections that we preserved in that last bill away, I think is not a good idea. Bad public policy and should clearly not go forward.
Representative Slocum.
Would thank you, Mr. Chair. Could Mr. Elwood come back? I have a question that I think between the two of you, you might be able to answer. There are a lot of promises made here, and there's no guarantees. Nothing's guaranteed, and there's really minimal recourse if something doesn't happen the way you're hoping that it happens. I'd like to know what the history's been in some of the other states. What have they experienced that have gone to the VoIP method?
Who wants to go first? Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum, there have been, the FCC has opened up an investigation around what they call sunny day outages, where there are more outages now in these deregulated states because of the lack of oversight that has been taken. What this bill does is take the PUC's authority completely away. I mean, that's what it does. So they can't handle any complaints. They can't enforce any of the statutes or the regulations. All of the service quality rules that exist will be unenforceable and ineffective. And so what's happened in some of these states is that, so the sunny day, for example, outages happen when there's bad weather. I mean, that makes sense. So you have a big storm, and that makes sense. But what's happening, and at least the FCC is talking about, is that they don't, it's a beautiful sunny day, and now we're getting more outages. New York has, which had this problem, or had deregulated, is experiencing more service quality problems, more complaints from consumers about service. And California has actually had some very serious concerns about their 911 system after they deregulated. So, that's kind of what's the result of all of this.
Representative Crescia, do you want to take a crack at that too?
No.
Representative Slocum?
Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Well, just one follow-up question, and I'll ask this to Mr. Elwood. So I don't want to play gotcha to Representative Crescia because I already got the answer. That's kind of ridiculous. Do you think customers should be able to go to the PUC if they have bogus charges on their bills? As I understand the legislation that Representative Crescia has presented, that would no longer be effective. Is that correct?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, that is correct. The PUC would have no authority for a call that was made through a VoIP phone, through a VoIP VoIP landline, to be able to address a problem where bogus charges were put on the bill.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, I don't want to drag it out. So I have this Fortune magazine article here from just a month ago or so that says AT&T to pay out $88 million in refunds over bogus charges starting today. So it happens, right? And it seems to me we should have some place for our customers to go to report that and to get some resolution.
Representative Crescia.
We have the Attorney General's office, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. Not seeing any other questions, Representative Slocum?
Oh.
You know, I'm sitting here shuffling. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Sitting here shuffling papers. I'd like a roll call on this one.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Representative Kreisha, we'll give you the final word. You can't have a roll call. Representative Slocum's already asked one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask people to actually look at the facts. And let's not paint senior citizens into who they are and who they are not. They're traveling in RVs. They're using technologies. My son, as an airman in Guam, calls his grandmother through Facebook all the time. People are using the technologies that they choose, and consumers are able to make those choices. The bill that I worked with last year, that just shows that we're still allowing landlines to exist. We're not taking them away. Nothing in what we're doing here is allowing us to take those landlines away. So I would just leave this in the words of an IT friend of mine, Moses, who said, "Mr. Chair, let my packets go."
Wow. With that, Representative Kreisha renews his motion that House File 1665, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Chair Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative Fenton.
Aye.
Representative Allen. Representative Sarah Anderson. Representative Applebaum. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Davids.
Aye.
Representative Cranzen.
Aye.
Representative Helverson. Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Loon.
No. Aye.
Representative Loonan. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
No.
Representative Slocum.
No.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Swidzinski.
Aye.
By a vote of 11 to 5, the bill does pass. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Members and everybody, the guests, thank you for sticking around so late. We got out of here just slightly later than 3:45. Members, we are adjourned. See you tomorrow night.